We'll start today with a open up on a hearing and work session here on I'll find it. Yeah, 36 House Bill 3606. And those who would like to give testimony first that I sponsored the bill for, please come forward.
Very good.
Senator Mayee first, I'm sure.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me an opportunity to testify first. I appreciate this. For the record, I'm State Senator Mayee representing Senator District 19, which comprises of portions of Lane and Bentley County. I fully support House Bill 3606 and urge that you pass it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. At a time when federal agencies mandate environmental expenditures without even being able to measure the results, it is paramount the industries affected by these mandates be given every opportunity to comply, not only to protect the industries and the environment, but the hundreds of jobs affected. House Bill 3606 allows for the selling or trading of pollution control tax credits to enable the pulp and paper industry in Oregon to meet these Environmental Protection Agency mandates by year 2001, even though this portion of the forest products industry is in serious slowdown. Hope and Talbot, Inc., located in Halsey, is in my district. It is one of the companies affected by the EPA mandate, and because of the economic downturn in the pulp industry, finds it difficult to finance a $35 million project that threatens closure of their facility if not completed in the prescribed time frame. They are unable to take advantage of Oregon's pollution control tax credit program because they are not making money in the state. Yet, this company has been an environmental leader in Oregon. Without their leadership and strong financial support, the recently completed Willamette River environmental study could not have taken place, and the results from the study would not be available to others for future work on the river. In my mind, it would be unrealistic not to support a program that would help companies that have worked closely with environmental agencies to protect our Willamette River and our environment. For these reasons, I urge that you favorably consider House Bill 3606.
Thank you, Senator Yee. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Others may come up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack McIsaac, and I represent Pope and Talbot support of House Bill 3606. With me is the President of Pope and Talbot and Chief Operating Officer, as well as the Director of Taxes. Mike Flannery is the President. Director of Taxes is Patricia DePinto Whittington, which is a long name, but you can call her Patricia. At any rate, Mr. Flannery will be making the company's presentation in support of the bill.
Thank you, Jack. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Flannery. I'm the President and Chief Operating Officer of Pope and Talbot Incorporated. Pope and Talbot is headquartered in Portland and is the oldest forest products company in the United States. We were founded in 1849 in Port Gamble, Washington, and the company operates a pulp mill in Halsey, Oregon, several sawmills in South Dakota and Wyoming, as well as British Columbia. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3606. The bill would enable pulp and paper mills in the state of Oregon to use a common method of financing called a sale and leaseback method as a way to finance the construction of a large-scale pollution control facility. In a sale and leaseback, the company sells the facility to an investor, and then leases it back to operate the business. The current law already allows certain recycling facilities to use that sale and leaseback technique, and this bill would extend that treatment to pulp and paper mills. The Halsey Mill was built in 1968 by the American Can Company. It's the newest mill of its kind west of the Mississippi. Pope and Talbot became a partner in the Halsey Pulp Mill in 1978 and became the sole owner in 1983. Our company paid a total of $38.5 million to acquire the Halsey Mill. Since then, we have invested more than $40 million in pollution control equipment at that mill. As a result, the Halsey Mill is one of the most environmentally advanced mills in the world. We're proud of our record of compliance with pollution control laws. We have an excellent record of working cooperatively with federal and state environmental authorities. And as Senator Yeats mentioned, in the mid-90s, we took lead in gathering financial and technical support for the Willamette River study. Pollution control tax credits first came upon the scene in Oregon in 1967, asked by the legislature not only to encourage environmental pollution control expenditures in the state by existing businesses, but also to attract new industry to the state. These tax credits enabled companies to invest in environmental improvements by allowing them to recover 50% of their environmental expenditures over a period of 10 years through a reduction in taxes. Over the years, such credits have helped the high-tech industry, utilities, and many other manufacturers. When pulp and paper mills earn taxable income, these credits are very helpful. Unfortunately, the EPA and other federal and state agencies may impose environmental requirements even during low points in the industry's business cycle. The pulp and paper industry now is in a downturn because of the unstable Asian economy and similar economic situations in South America and Europe. In addition, our industry must compete with pulp producers in other parts of the world that are not nearly as protective of the environment as we are here in America. In 1998, our company lost nearly $17 million at the Halsey Mill. In fact, it's been in the last few years, which is the first time we've experienced downtime due to market-related events in the industry. We are confident that a new upward phase of the business cycle is ahead, but in the meantime, we are unable to use the tax credit for pollution control facilities, and we face an EPA-mandated deadline for installing those facilities. The bill would help level out the effects of the business cycle for pulp and paper companies because outside investors who pay to build pollution control facilities will be allowed to claim the credit. Those investors can use the credit and, in effect, pass the credit back to the companies in the form of lower cost of capital and funds, which is very important. The recently issued EPA Plus rules require that pulp mills across the nation install new and additional pollution control facilities by 2001, or they'll face a federally mandated shutdown. In Pope and Talbot's case, the company must install $35 million worth of additional equipment to a mill that's already one of the most, if not the most, environmentally advanced plants of its kind. Installation of this new equipment will now bring to more than $75 million the amount of money we invested in environmental control at this one mill. And this is almost twice the amount we paid for the mill and have invested in facilities producing pulp. The new pollution control equipment must be installed by 2001, or the EPA will not allow the mill to operate further, and jobs of more than 200 employees, whose average wage, including the benefits, is about $774,000 a year, and they will be in jeopardy. In addition to those jobs, we estimate that 800 jobs that depend indirectly on the Halsey Mill would be lost throughout the state. Linn County would lose property taxes of more than $500,000 a year from the mill alone. The state would lose $800,000 a year in income taxes paid by our employees, and property tax revenues would decline in the Linn, Benton, and Lane County area as workers left to find other jobs. All in all, we believe the Halsey Mill generates more tax revenues than the amount of the tax credits that we already would benefit from if the industry were not in this downturn. We strongly feel that this bill is revenue neutral to Oregon. It is possible that environmental groups or even Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality might oppose Bill 3606, when we believe they shouldn't. This is a bill that enables companies in Oregon to meet the mandate of the Federal Environmental Protection Agency during a worldwide depressed market. It seems inconsistent with the mission of the environmental groups to oppose regulations that will assist in improving the environment, and it seems inconsistent for a state agency to oppose regulations that seek to encourage its mission. Again, we believe the bill is to be revenue neutral. The statute is not being extended. House Bill 3606 allows affected companies to continue to be environmentally responsible in a negative economy. Pope and Talbot and others in our industry have existed in the state for many years, have grown with the state, and have contributed to the welfare of Oregon citizens through corporate participation, attractive wages, and by paying our share of taxes. Our property taxes and those of our employees have contributed to Oregon schools, and we believe that this bill will help companies like ours to continue to contribute to Oregon's prosperity. We urge you to pass on HB 3606 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation, and I'll be happy to answer any further questions, and thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your opinion, does the bill apply in a broader application than just to your own mail?
Mr. Chair and Representative Taylor, as I understand it, the bill applies to the pulp and paper industries and paper mills in general, so whoever fits that kind of category would be able to utilize this very specific change.
Other questions? No. Anyone else want to give testimony?
I think Irv Fletcher is here, Mr. Chairman. Too.
That'd be great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Irv Fletcher, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. The testimony is over here. I won't read it. You folks can read it. As we understand the bill, it would request technical changes so that Pope and Talbot can move ahead with a $35 million project to bring it into compliance with Oregon's environmental laws. I'm here today representing, at the request of the five local unions who represent the employees at Pope and Talbot. It's their wish that we support that, they support it, and I'm more than happy to open any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Fletcher. Questions? You see, my committee is really anticipating moving legislation today, right? Not any questions. Thank you. I appreciate that. Sadiq, do you want to give a testimony on this at all? I don't see a raised hand. Anyone else want to give testimony on this particular piece of legislation? Hearing none, close hearing, and I will open now that we have all our, at least a quorum. We certainly have everyone here.
All of them.
We'll open a work session on House Bill 3606.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz. I move House Bill 3606 to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 3606 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Representative Devlin.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a clarification on it, and another year of misinformation. There's no extension of the pollution tax credit in these amendments, is there?
In the particular bill, an extension of?
Right.
No, I didn't see that.
No.
No, I don't think that was part of what we were doing here.
I'm just trying to clarify because I haven't had time to read that in the amendment.
There is not a lot of language in the particular bill, okay? And I did not run across that.
Other sure.
That's in Merkley.
Do we have a revenue impact prepared for this bill?
Revenue impact? There is none prepared at this point in time.
Mr. Chairman, members, we don't have a statement issued to us yet, other than the fact that there may be a revenue impact.
What I do have is Legislative Revenue Office has determined that 3606 has a possible revenue impact on state or local revenue. That's all I've got.
Mr. Chair, I know we have a motion on the floor, but I'd like to recommend that we send this on to Revenue Committee to weigh with the other tax credit changes that the committee has been addressing and then on to obtain a fiscal impact. Revenue impact before we proceed.
I think that what we intended, Jack, do you want to come up or Mr. Flannery?
You want to
talk about this?
Chairman, Representative Merkley, if this bill gets through the House, which we anticipate it will, it is scheduled to go to the Senate Revenue Committee, at which time all the revenue implications will be addressed. And that is our intent for it to happen. We have talked with the DEQ, and we are working with the DEQ to check that out as well. So your concern, which you discussed with me when we talked about it earlier, will be addressed at that time.
And I feel comfortable with that. Any other discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I won't be able to support the bill without it going to the Revenue Committee as well.
That's fine. And we may, if I pass, if we pass this out here, I might get directed to do that too by the speaker. Just talking with him. But we are certainly trying to get as many of our house bills out today. And those that do have revenue or fiscal implications, we're trying to get as much work done on those as possible at this point. And we know there's some delays. So. And I think we can take care of that over on the Senate side. That's our intention. Okay. Any other discussion? Please call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Devlin? Aye. Representative Pinella? Aye. Representative McCorry?
Aye.
Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Representative
Taylor? Aye.
Aye. And the required number of votes, House Bill 606 moves to the close of the DPAS recommendation. We close the work session on House Bill 3606. And let's have a carrier. I would be more than happy to carry a chair. That's maybe I shouldn't
come up. That's fine.
Okay. Well, for Carol. Okay. And let's go to, is there any other legislator here? Let's open on work session on House Bill 2801.
Simple bill.
You can do it from up here. That's an action.
How many hearings have we had on this bill?
Okay. Well, that's why I originally got up committee members, because I got nervous that we were going to have another hearing.
We just have a work session here.
Let me explain where we have, without going into too much detail, how we have fixed the previous concerns of the last, which I don't know what number the last hearing was, multiple hearings. We have taken the dash twos, if you recall, had criminal trespass and changed substantially some relating legal language. We changed that, or we actually left that alone, and developed, as you'll see in the dash threes, line seven, the person who commits trespass under this, again, recall that this is an option two, not a forceful posting up, but a option two. We have created trespass in the third degree. This language in this amendment closely reflects the language that was in the, I forget the number, but it was the bill that we addressed last week regarding railroads. Very closely. In fact, if you recall, or if you look on page two, line 18, you'll see that the fining amount was increased to reflect the language that we approved previously. I will just add one thing. I think we've met all the concerns here. I feel very good about the dash threes. The dash threes don't touch criminal. Again, they create trespass in the third degree. I would only ask us to fix one thing that we talked about. I think it was in the second, third, or fourth, somewhere in our early hearings on this, a conceptual amendment to line 20. Line 20 in the dash 3 has this the two-word phrase, entire post. I would like that to be conceptually amended to say approximate top 6 inches. That actually uses some language that was recommended by Representative Cruz, approximate top 6 inches. So with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. Or have the members who helped us draft this answer the questions.
Representative Atkinson, that whole sentence that does contain that does refer to 50 square inches of fluorescent orange paint.
Right. That's also, as you recall, this is 50 square inches. That would be for a non-fence post type of marker to use.
Any clarification, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay, so on line 20, we're eliminating the word the entire fence post and inserting the approximate top 6 inches.
Yes. Of the, I'll forget those two words, of the post. Actually, get rid of the word entire.
Yeah, just entire. Get rid of that.
Oh, okay.
And put
okay. Sorry, I'll do this in pencil.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
That's it before.
Representative Atkinson, at our last hearing, the state police had some concerns about the bill has been addressed.
I believe so. Captain Ball, if he'd like to say a few words, or even Justin Burns, who helped us, would be here, I think, would be more than happy to discuss the amendments.
Captain Ball. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lindsey Ball. I'm captain of the Fish and Wildlife Division for the State Police. What Representative Atkinson did with the amendments was that he removed all of the elements of culpability required under criminal law, and he also took away the need to decriminalize criminal trespass in the second degree. And so there is no impact on current law at this time.
And boy, wasn't that a great relief to see that we...
Certainly was for me.
Eight pages of dash to amendments referring to... at least 100 ORS.
Mr. Chair.
That's the name, monthly.
Well, for those of us who don't have the criminal law background, how does that work? I thought it had to do with people where you couldn't be criminally liable because of criminal trespass because people weren't necessarily be aware. You couldn't prove they were aware of what they were doing. But isn't this contain that same element?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, no, because as classified as a violation, you don't have the same level as a crime.
So we've reverted it back to criminal trespass, but we decreased it to a violation?
That's correct. Level. It's criminal trespass in the third degree, I believe, is how it will read.
Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chair, to be clear, the dash trees then are the only amendments that would, yeah. It would preclude the ones and twos and
right.
Would have the effect of changing a fine to $1,000 from $250?
Correct. That is right. Okay. There's no need for the dash one. Let's do that. Right.
No, we can successfully do line 20. Like
yeah. I think we can. That's approximate top 6 inches of the. I think can. That's close enough. I think it's simple enough to do that. Okay. Any other testimony? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to first move the dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2801.
Want to do the conceptual first?
Should we do the conceptual first? Conceptually, Mr. Chair, I'd like to conceptually amend the dash 3 amendment. Line 20, remove word entire and insert the words approximately top 6 inches of the to line 20.
That's a Atkinson's conceptual amendment on the dash 3 is to the dash 3 amendment on line 20. It'll be eliminating the word entire and inserting approximate top 6 inches of the. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Any opposition? Hearing none. So moved.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash 3 amendments as conceptually amended to House Bill 2801.
And Representative Atkinson moves the dash 3 amendments as conceptually amended to House Bill 2801. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Any opposition? Hearing none. So moved.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2801 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative has amended and conceptually amended.
As amended and conceptually.
Representative Atkinson moves House Bill 2801 as conceptually amended and dash 3 amendments to the full of the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
I would just like to commend Representative Atkinson for his hard work on this bill. He has spent, we've had numerous hearings on this bill, and he deserves a big round of applause for that.
Great learning experience, isn't it? No doubt.
Just a small technical bill.
Isn't that what he opened up with?
Yeah.
Small technical bill. Okay. Very good. Clerk, please call the roll.
Hi. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. I wonder who I carry this one.
Having a required number of votes, House Bill 2801 is conceptually and as amended and vastly amended, pass the floor to do pass recommendation.
As amended. I'll be back in 2 minutes. Okay,
yes. Atkinson is the carrier. And we close the work session in 2001. And the opening work session on up to 3054. We have the dash twos, and I think the conceptional crew, if we can, so we can move this on. Mm-hmm.
Oh, the conceptual item, $1,000 or more than that.
We've got, yeah, we're going to do $1,000 to keep that consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And we would like to add, I think you have a memo here, some tax bus communications. If you take a look at the last page, which is the opposite page, and you'll see proposed amendments at the bottom. So I understand we do have approval from sponsor of the bill.
Mr. Chair, could you repeat the bill number, please?
House Bill 3054. And at this time of the session, you see that relating clauses are quite important, too.
We don't have
an official amendment. What we have is, you see that we have a memo that came from PASRAC. Yeah. Now look on the back page. And at the very bottom, you'll find the proposed amendment that we'd like to place in the estimate. Frank, last race. You want to talk about this?
I don't think I have it really.
Okay, we'll get your copy then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ray Phelps, and I'm here representing Hobby Iron Kennels. This is a situation where the land use process is processing somebody right out of business. And very bluntly, very specifically stated, these folks, a nice young couple, purchased from their uncle the kennels in 1989. The kennel had been operating on the island since the early 50s. In 1990, they were approved by the Multnomah County to add a dwelling, their home, adjacent to the kennel building. In 1989, the current owners and operators of the Shores remodeled the kennel with approval of Multnomah County. In 1993, LCDC deleted kennel operations as a conditional use on high-value farmland. And in that year, Multnomah County informed the current owners and operators that they did not need a conditional use permit for their kennel operation. In 1996, Multnomah County approved the kennels as a non-conforming use. The action was appealed to LUBA, and LUBA instructed Multnomah County they must establish the nature and extent of the use of the use of it and use this baseline as the basis for the expansion to measure whether that expansion would be of no greater adverse impact on the neighborhood. We have provided different committee people, and I have a complete set for the record of the various kinds of testimony at the conditional use hearing, where virtually everyone on the island either testified in person or provided in writing support for the issuing of the permit for the kennel to continue to operate as non-conforming use. In the meanwhile, since 1996, there has been litigation ongoing, which has cost these people a great deal of money. And I think it's just a matter of simple justice. The people were there before the rule changed. The kennels were there for as long as the early 50s. The neighbors and the people living there all agree that they ought to continue. They're not the only kennel operation on the island. There are actually three. And so our proposal is that if a licensed commercial dog kennel in existence on January 1, 1990, it shall be deemed approved under this subsection. And that's the hand and gross that I believe you've received.
Questions?
You're like an attack of confusion down here, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair. We wondered if this was a button stuff or if this was an addition.
No, this would be an additional amendment. We're going to run down to legislative council and make sure that it'll fit and it's okay. And before we pass it out, because we can move on to another bill real quick, I just want to open up here and give Ray a moment to talk about what he wanted to do here. Okay? Let's hit it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the amendment has merit and the bill does not.
It's sort of like watching my worst enemy go over the cliff in my new car. React.
I've been devil. As long as we're taking time here, I think the amendment has merit, and I encourage Mr. Fox for what he's doing, that he should attach his amendment to a horse that's going to finish the race.
That's a good bill.
Okay.
I'm not a betting person.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, yeah.
President Cruz.
I'm just curious as to exactly, is this amendment just attached to the bottom of the bill with its own reference?
That's what we've been talking about.
Okay,
I think that's correct. With a relating clause relating to land, it's pretty wide open there. And but there's certain question of germaneness. I think maybe the bill works out what it refers to. Let's move on to the next bill here. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's close the work session on 354 and we'll open the work session on House Bill 3346. We have, I think, probably some people want to talk about that real quick here. Yes? Come on up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Becklin. I'm here today, and you'll see from the handout that you're about to get that I'm here today to testify regarding House Bill 3346 from the perspective of the chair of the governor's Savage Rapid Dam Task Force. I want to point out to the members of the committee today that this bill is only about protecting the environment. You know that I have been here on previous occasions with issues that related to Savage Rapids Dam. This bill is very specific in mandating that before any dam or obstruction in the state of Oregon is removed from a waterway, that a sediment study be conducted to assure that the river in which the dam may be located is not adversely affected as a result of the removal of the dam. If you will, you'll see that there are some color photographs that are a part of this written testimony.
If you'll go over to the second page of color photographs, I want to show to you the results of the discovery effort by the Savage Rapids Dam Task Force. Savage Rapids Dam is only one example of the potential areas for great destruction to our rivers. It can result from removing dams and obstructions without first studying to determine if the sediments themselves are potentially hazardous. And you'll see in these photographs evidence that is not typically viewable except once or twice a year when the lake has been lowered. But in fact, what we know about Savage Rapids Dam is that it currently contains somewhere approaching a million cubic yards of sediments of a variety of ages and a variety of types. Also in this testimony today, if you will swing over to the second numbered page, are the basic findings of the Savage Rapids Dam Task Force. What we determined is that dams that have been removed in North America typically do not get a significant amount of study and publicity because very often the owners of those structures are very concerned about the liabilities associated with potential damage to rivers where those dams have been removed. But you'll find in pages 3 and 4 of my testimony today specific examples of dams that have either been deliberately removed or that were broken as a result of the flood damage and that caused sedimentation collected at those dams to move downstream. Certainly the most recent example, and it's quite close to home, is the Valsep Dam on the Siletz River in Oregon. I think you may end up hearing the Water Resources Department indicate that they think that the removal of the Valsep Dam was quite a success. The problem with the removal of the Valsep and the removal of other dams is that typically the adverse effect of the sediments that are flushed downstream isn't learned about until somewhat later. And the purpose of this bill is to ensure that we protect one of our primary assets in the state of Oregon, and that is our beautiful waterways. I would encourage you to take a look very seriously at the testimony that I presented today as it affects case studies, real examples of rivers in North America that have been seriously adversely affected as a result of either the deliberate or the accidental breaching of dams and the flushing of sediments into those rivers without having first determined in advance if the sediments would be dangerous to the river. Secondly, in the case of the Rogue River and Savage Rapids Dam, we now in the future will have a sediment study, a very detailed sediment study. I'm very pleased to tell you that a coalition of parties encouraged the Bureau of Reclamation to seek the reprogramming of funding left over from their budget last year. The federal government, by an act of the Congress early this year, has provided $350,000 to conduct a sediment study in the Rogue River for the sediments that lay in a two-mile stretch above Savage Rapids Dam. This clearly is a step in the right direction. I'm very hopeful that the combined results of that study and a $75,000 study that I personally funded last year, I mean out of my own pocket because I'm so concerned about the Rogue River, that the combined results of the study from last year and the $350,000 study by the federal government will result in a very solid basis for determining the potential effect of the sediments on the Rogue River in the event that Savage Rapids Dam ultimately is removed. And finally, I'm very hopeful that this will set a fine example in other rivers, not only in the state of Oregon, but throughout the United States, that mandates that we protect our rivers even if we end up removing our dams. I'd be pleased to take any questions that you may have.
Questions from the committee?
Yes, thanks for coming up again.
Real quick, you said to the committee last time, perhaps you should remind the committee when the current study is scheduled to be done and completed.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkinson, the current study that is underway by the federal government is proposed to last approximately 18 months. The work study, in fact, will begin tomorrow in Grants Pass. The study needs to be designed. I think that it's too early to say if 18 months is exactly the amount of time that it will take. But clearly this type of study cannot be done overnight.
Follow-up comment?
Sure.
Thank you also for this written testimony. I would ask my colleagues to look on page 3 and 4 for some... just as you've been talking, briefing myself on these examples, I think these are good examples of why we would want to do this. Not to mention the fact that we really don't know what's behind some of these very old dams. So.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkinson, if I might answer that question. I have two books here today. These are documents that were prepared by the State of Oregon, the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. The first is dated 1943. This is a book that details the locations and the output of every mine in Jackson County, Oregon. In the watershed upstream from Savage Rapids Dam, there were 222 mines. The second book that I have details the locations and the output of all of the quicksilver mines in the state of Oregon. That is mercury. What we know is that there were a significant number of mercury mines in our watershed because the mercury in those days was first mined in order to be able to mine and take the placer gold that was subsequently taken. So a quick examination of the history of an area like ours, where a dam of 77 years has been collecting sediments in an area that is one of the two largest heavy metals mining areas in the state of Oregon, where we have heavy orcharding in this area, where there were lead arsenic-type pesticides used prior to the 1960s, I believe. We have every reason, if we love our state, and I think all of you are in this committee probably because you have a great interest in the land and in our water. This is a very smart approach to guaranteeing that in the process of trying to do something about infrastructure, we don't end up destroying the very rivers in which that infrastructure is located. I would really encourage each of you to search your hearts here today. This is not a politically motivated bill. This is one that has everything to do with protecting my river as well as all of the other waterways in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make a statement about we had a dredging the river. We had a bill that was concerning dredging the river to make it possible that boats could have passage down the river. And some of the opposition was those very things, that the gravel would being removed would bring those kinds of things to the surface and be dangerous. So I would think that a dam with all that water, it would certainly be a lot more than just a little dredging to make it navigable. So it's just my statement I'd like to make. Thank you.
President Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Beckman, while you say it isn't politically motivated, isn't it true that this measure, if we passed it, would have an extensive consequence to the Water Resources Department and delay considerably the deal that was struck in 1994 regarding the removal of Savage Rapids Dam?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, no, I don't think that is correct. In fact, the sediment study that is now underway by the federal government is a necessary advance step before any ultimate decision could be made about Savage Rapids Dam. I think that it is clear that the passage of this bill will not affect the future of Savage Rapids Dam, the structure. But it clearly will have an effect on saving and guaranteeing that this beautiful river is not adversely affected if and when a Savage Rapids Dam is removed from the river.
Other questions? Mr. Van Merkel?
What are the requirements of 279.05 and 279.111 that are referred to in the first line of the bill?
In fact, I cannot respond to that.
I'll bring this book down. I looked that up myself. It deals with public contracting and bids and the procedure for doing contracts like that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Rep. Michael.
This refers to removal of a dam or artificial obstruction. On the Columbia River, there's a number of old pilings that have been established to direct flow into the center of the river, some of which are practically dysfunctional. I'm just wondering if the artificial obstruction clause is fairly broad for a major river. There's lots of artificial obstruction. Almost every dock and pier is an artificial obstruction.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, you should know that in May of last year, the National Marine Fisheries Service, through a Federal Register announcement, redefined the word harm under the Endangered Species Act. You should know that disturbing the river bottom in an area in a waterway that constitutes habitat for an endangered species is now considered to be harm. Literally, today, you cannot stick a shovel into the river bottom in the Rogue River without it potentially being a violation of the Endangered Species Act. I think that's probably smart. I think that it's critical for us to recognize that anything that we do in this habitat has the potential for adversely affecting the very fish that we are now so serious about recovering. And so if it is a piling or if it is a much larger structure such as a dam, and if there is the potential for disgorging sediments that have accumulated at that point, I think it's a very wise policy for us to remember that, you know, these structures, all of them, have only been here as long as European man has been in Oregon. But the rivers took thousands of years to form, and they will be here long after all of us are gone. We must not, for the sake of a year or two, or for the sake of a few thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars of study, not protect these wonderful waterways in this state.
Other questions? Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you very much.
We then have Water Resource Department. Director Pendle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Martha Pagel, Water Resources Department. We're having handed out to you written testimony on behalf of the department. I know you've got a lot to cover, so I will very much rely on the written testimony, but there are a few points I would like to bring to your attention. The Water Resources Department would strongly oppose this measure, certainly not because we don't share the concern for protection of the resource, but because this measure is overly broad and we think it has the potential to do much more harm than good for protection of water resources and protection of public safety. The measure would apply to virtually any and all structures, legal or illegal, would prohibit us from taking any action to demand the removal of an illegal structure, for example, without having first gone through the sediment study. Doesn't distinguish between how large, how small, whether it's a very minor type of obstruction, which we do require to be removed if it's an illegal structure. So there are many flaws in the way the bill is put together that just make it overly broad and difficult to implement. It's also a question of burden. If the department is taking action with respect to public safety on an existing structure or with respect to an illegal structure, should the state of Oregon pay the cost of a sediment study? If the concern is to make sure that we have sediment studies done and that we have conditions to protect the resource in place, that's a legitimate concern. It's something that I can tell you that we do, as a matter of course, and that any removal project would be conducted in a way that includes conditions to protect the resource. But if you're concerned about that, tell us to do that. Don't tell us to conduct a sediment study on any type of decision before we can make the decision and before we can move forward with public safety and resource protection.
Question from the committee. Okay. Well, looking at what we have at the bottom here as far as what we information is gained from Fiscal 2, which is part of this. Oh. Should just have a copy of it. So we just received it. We would have to go raise the means anyway, looking at up to a possible cost of $250,000, even if we narrow down the language, it's very specific here. We probably have to send it back to Ray to me. So what we will we'll do is look at some more specific language, I think, on this. Because we know this is another... I think they want to be specific. Dennis? Is that all right with you? We can take a look at some amendments here to narrow this down. Well, as far as the impact in consideration for other projects. Come on up. Yeah, you need to identify yourself, please.
Mr. Chairman, Dennis Beckman again for the record. If there is a question about the scope of the language, that is, if it is a question of affecting a single fence post as opposed to affecting a structure that really does restrain a significant amount of sediment, I certainly would agree that language could be changed. And to the extent that there is a need to review cost impact, that too could be subject to review. There are a variety of potentially responsible parties. They include not only state government, but they include all of those for whom the structures hold personal value. It could be the ownership as well.
Okay, I think that's what we'll do. We'll just put together a little. I mean, if we're going to talk about Savage Rapid Dam, maybe we will narrow it right down to that and put it specifically in this bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to appeal to you to understand that this bill was not written specifically for Savage Rapid Dam. It is a much broader look at the implications of the task force recommendations and the need for all, all our waterways.
For all waterways.
You bet.
Yes. Director Payne.
Okay, with respect to the Savage Rapids Dam, I just wanted to make clear for the record that the Water Resources Department and Commission have from the outset expected that a sediment study would be done and sediment conditions would be attached to any removal plan with the engineering. We just never got that far in the process. Preliminary work was done and an assessment was done by the Bureau of Reclamation in connection with an environmental impact statement that was prepared early on in evaluating the option of dam removal. In addition, the state engineer has examined the site. The conclusions were that obviously sediment work needed to be done. A feasibility study would have been contracted for after, as the process proceeds in developing the engineering plan for the actual removal. Again, it's a matter of timing and who should pay the cost of it.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond to that just very briefly? It is true that there is cost associated with sediment, removing the sediment, because it could be potentially contaminated, can be extraordinarily expensive. This is getting the cart before the horse to say, approve the project and study the sediment later. We need to know what the cost impacts of a project of this magnitude are, and we need to include in the study of front-end costs an examination of the cost of the sediments as well.
Mr. Chair, I promise I won't say this much longer, but I have to respond to say that, again, we have to consider the size and scope and type of decision that one is making. If it's a discretionary choice whether to remove a dam or leave it in place, and when you have legitimate options to do either, that's one case, and certainly cost-benefit analysis is appropriate in that setting. If you're talking about an illegal structure that's doing harm to people or to the resource, then the cost of dealing with the sediment arguably should be borne by the person or entity responsible for having placed that, and it should not be a factor other than requiring that the structure be removed with conditions to protect from sediment damage.
Yes, it would be an argument over legal or illegal. Trust, obviously. So I think we'll work on this just a little bit longer here. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Close the fourth session and House Bill 3346. And let's move back up the work session on House Bill 3054. We received information that we would be able to put the placing amendments in House Bill 3054 in Legislative Council because of the relating clause.
Sure.
That makes sense.
I would move the conceptual amendment to House Bill 3054 that would add the appropriate place the language on page 2 of the memo from PacWest. John Kennel's not described in subsection Trans 1, Trans J of this section, currently licensed commercial dog kennels in existence on January 1st, 1990, shall be deemed approved under the subsection.
That's approved. Move we adopt the conceptual amendment. As you read on the memo from PacWest Communications here, the language currently licensed commercial dog kennels in existence in January 1, 1990 shall be deemed approved under this subsection as pertaining to ORS 215-283 sub 2 sub n. And as I understand, those will fit in the bill and the dash. Okay, any discussion on that? Hearing none, any objection? Hearing none, so moved.
I move to conceptually amend the dash 2 amendment by adding on line 12 a figure 1,000 to the dollar sign.
That's approved. Request the motion to add to the dash 2 amendment on line 12 the number 1,000, where you see there was a blank. Give us a fine of up to $1,000. Any discussion? President Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since I don't believe we've had any testimony in committee on this, do you know who requested this amendment?
Yes, so I think we did have testimony on this. I was going to, in fact, that one day I think I was going to move it, but we didn't have enough people here to move legislation, so I think we left it. Undone.
Mr. Chairman, who requested the amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, that was Representative Manick, and he came and talked to the committee about this amendment and about a work group that's revising all of these violations, and that's why it was a blank line, and it can come to the $1,000 figure.
Okay, thank you.
Further discussion? Any opposition?
I can't support the bill because of my concern for children who can't read trespassing signs and for whom an attractive nuisance might exist. I know of cases in the past where children have fallen into abandoned wells on property, and I also am concerned. While I know that this is useful for the railroads, and I wish there was some way that we could get to their concerns for people who hang out around their facilities, I still am concerned for my own hometown where the track is the only flat place in town. People do walk along it. And I haven't been able to have those concerns satisfied, so I have to oppose the bill.
Okay. Any other opposition? Representative Mercury and Representative Taylor.
I'm
not objecting to the amendments. You asked if there's opposition to the bill. I will be voting against.
Okay. No, I'm just on. I'm on the conceptual amendments right now.
Oh, are you?
Not to the whole bill.
I'm sorry. I was looking to the bill.
So that was for the conceptual amendment, $1,000. And further objections, so moved.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cruz.
I move the -2 amendment to House Bill 3054 as conceptually amended.
Representative Cruz.
The addition of the previous conceptual amendment.
We already did that to the bill. I didn't do that to the -2.
I'm moving it to the bill.
No, I meant the first conceptual was to the bill.
Did you restate your motion?
Well, the motion is to move the -2 House Bill 3054 as conceptually amended.
Representative Cruz moves the -2 amendment to House Bill 3054 as conceptually amended. Any further discussion? Any opposition? Hearing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
I move House Bill 3054 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 3054 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor to be passed recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Dedman.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I will be voting no on the bill and I'm serving notice of a possible minority report.
Okay. Any other discussion? Clerk, please call the roll. As amended and concession amended, passed this vote to do pass recommendation. And Representative Devlin serves notice of possible minority report. Representative Corey is going to.
And my partner in crime.
And who would like to be the carrier? We'll have Representative Mannix carry the bill. We'll close the work session, House Bill 3054. We open a work session, House Bill 2600. Anyone here to speak on the -2 amendment?
Farewell, Laura Schroeder. Just to update the committee, the -2 amendments are, as we discussed in the previous hearing, as option one. They're exactly the same. We met with the just an update. We met with the department after our last hearing in hopes of making option one even more palatable to the department. Unfortunately, the solution that was offered would require a diversion facility, at least in the Rogue River, in the winter months, and obviously that would be important not only to the district but also individuals. We also learned at that work session with the department that GPID's conservation plan may not be accepted pursuant to the -2 amendments requiring the conservation plan, but GPID is willing to work on that and make sure that their conservation plan, which was one of the first ones in the state, complies with the requirements. So we offer the -2 amendments, and I also want to compliment Jan Lee, who worked with us to write. Thank you, Chair.
Could you explain one more time what the -2s are doing here?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. two amendments, if you turn to page two, it makes a diversion to an irrigation district exempt from getting a water right if the water is used. It's for only the amount of water that is lost to seepage or evaporation.
Okay.
And the reason we need this bill, Chair, well, is that we have 3,000 families dependent on water from the GPID seepage and evaporation, and we do not have water quantified in our certificate for that purpose.
Large. We don't need the dash one.
No.
Just the two.
Just the two.
Okay.
Two is to replace one.
Okay. Any questions? Any further questions? Water Resource Department, Martha, Director Page.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Martha Pagel, Water Resources Department. We've just seen the Dash 2 amendments today. They are really very similar to the Dash 1 amendments, but they set up a little more structure with the concept. But what's important to keep in mind here is that what this would do is create an outright exemption for no specified amount, for virtually any amount that the district determined was necessary to serve its purposes. It would, in that sense, create very new, unprecedented type of privilege for irrigation districts, and we think to the potential, severe potential for injury to other water right users and to the resource itself. So I testified previously when you heard the Dash 1 amendments and when we were discussing this issue with you that our concerns with this type of approach would be that we would need some type of process to evaluate how much water was needed and how it was going to affect other existing water rights on the system. And that was the nature of the discussions that we had with the district in the time between the last hearing and today's hearing, and we were not able to reach agreement. The district didn't feel that they were able to go through that type of process, so they haven't brought those types of amendments to you. But we cannot support these amendments without that. As I testified to you previously, this is an outright exemption for the use of surface water. Current law and longstanding law in Oregon doesn't allow much in the nature of outright exemption because it's very important to keep track. We have to know how much water is being used, when they're entitled to the use of it. So this is a very important concern for the protection of other water right holders and the public interest involved, and we vote that it's a fatal flaw that we do not have that type of process. With respect to protection of the other interests and of those people who are currently relying on the seepage in this particular district, as we discussed previously in my testimony on the original hearing on the First Amendment, the issue of aquifer recharge is one that, if it's necessary to be dealt with, can be dealt with under existing Oregon law. You don't need to change the law. This doesn't do anything to protect those folks. What this does is allow the district to take as much water as it needs to serve its system and to get the water through its system. The final point that I would make is that the bill, the amendments that are brought forward to attempt to create some strings to say that this is only allowed for irrigation districts formed under certain statutes and complying with a certain other statute. That other statute that it refers to is a special process for irrigation districts to be able to avoid forfeiture of water rights within their boundaries. And it says that they can take advantage of that program if they have a full-time manager and if they have an approved conservation plan. But once again, we have kind of poor drafting here. This says that they could have this outright exemption under the Dash 2 Amendment if they comply with the requirements of this other statute. But there aren't any real requirements of this other statute. And if they're simply saying that they would have a full-time manager and an approved conservation plan, that doesn't go at all to the issue of protection from injury. And the conservation plan would have been based on existing water right of the district and not this additional amount. So there are flaws in the drafting, but more importantly, there are serious flaws in the policy.
Director Pagel, it seems to me you said that the department does allow for carrying the water somehow.
So, Representative Taylor, most water rights that are issued include sufficient water to cover the carrying costs and carrying needs, the distribution needs of the system. We have a few isolated situations, and the Grants Pass District is one of them. That's, you know, sort of what set us off on this course of the difficulties that we've had, and everybody trying to resolve that problem. But typically, water rights do not specifically identify an amount for that purpose. It's that the total amount that's authorized for use includes enough to push the water through the system. So that comes out another problem here, that it would be very rare to have a water right or permit, certificate, or decree which actually quantified seepage or evaporation needs. So that would mean that this type of exemption would apply to most any water right held by a district.
Okay, other question? Okay. Anyone else want to give testimony on this? Laurel? Is there any willingness to make this more palatable?
Chair Welch, we have tried to make it more palatable, and the suggestion offered by the department with the idea that there are already opportunities for recharge permits, that's the one that I was referring to. You, on the Rogue River system, it would require that we put up the dam facility during the winter months in order to recharge those domestic wells. So that obviously is not a solution any of us want at this time. And as the director pointed out, this is a very unusual situation. Most water rights, as she suggested, do allow for this amount. It is, though, not only Grants Pass, but other districts who do not have this amount. And I think that in HA, the suggested exception is the amount of water loss. Obviously, the district requesting this exception is going to have to quantify the amount of water, and the department will have a chance then to work with the district to determine if that is the amount lost to seepage or evaporation, and it will be quantified. I think that covers some concerns that people may have about the amount of water. It's not just going to be any amount. It's going to be a set amount. And there is possibly room for rulemaking here from the Water Resources Department to set that amount. And then as to be the management of the district, it refers to the requirements of ORS 540-572-1. As the director pointed out, that requires a manager and also a conservation plan. The intent here is to have a conservation plan. Certainly, if the word requirements is objectionable, it can just say complies with ORS 540-572-1. This is a very, very narrow exception for only certain districts who don't have this quantification in their decrees. And I would, as a water lawyer, be testifying in objection to this if it was any amount. And I think if you remember back to the first bill, it was for any amount, and I couldn't support it. But I can support this, and I have worked with the other irrigation district organization, Oregon Water Resources Congress, to get it as narrow as we could so we wouldn't cause injury to other water users. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Lauren. Appreciate that. And we could conceptually eliminate the requirements of this applies with ORS 545-72. I know they're awaiting it. It's over in the Senate, so they can do more battle on it. Chair would like to move this out when we get a moment here. So I think I will close on the... let's check and see real quick. Thank you.
injury to the fences. I don't know where else to work on tonight.
Okay.
I'll go ahead and do a conception. First bill in the nurse checking the house bill 2600. And the chair moves conceptual amendment through the dash 2 amendment for house bill 2600. And conceptual will be on the second page of the dash 2. On line 12 and 13, we would eliminate the requirements of and would read, provided the management of the district complies with ORS 54572. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair,
I think approved.
You should do the conceptual of dash 2, right?
Yes.
I would move the dash 2 amendment as conceptual amendment.
That's approved. Move the dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2600 as conceptually amended. Any further discussion? Hearing none.
Are we down moving the bill?
No, not yet. Just the dash 2 amendments right now.
Thank you.
Okay. Any objection? Hearing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair?
That's very true.
I move House Bill 2600 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2600 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suppose this bill will pass out again, as the other bills for savvy traffic have on a party line. But I've been impressed with the number of letters I've gotten from Grants Pass residents who oppose this measure. I haven't gotten any from my own district, so it doesn't really matter in my own district. But I oppose this for the same reasons I oppose the other measures that have come before from the Grants Pass Irrigation District, and that is that I believe they have had the benefits of the deal that was struck and have seen none of the responsibilities, and now they come to the legislature seeking us as a legislative body granting water rights, preventing them completing the removal of the dam and going ahead with providing water to their residents of their district in an alternative option which is available to them, and so I'll oppose the measure.
Thank you, Representative. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, I oppose this bill. It has been clarified that there's an unspecified amount of water involved and that this is a unprecedented way to bypass our traditional water rights law that protects existing users and allocations in a methodical manner. And I think given, based on both the numerous letters I received from Grant staff on this, every single one opposing this bill, and the testimony of the water district, that it creates quite a compelling case that this is not in the best interest of the state.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
No.
Aye. No.
No.
Aye.
Aye. Having the required number of votes, House Bill 2600, there was amended and conception amended after the poll with the due pass recommendation. Carrier. Shall we give this to Representative Wilson again? Okay. Representative Wilson. And we'll close the work session on 2600. We'll open a work session on Bill 3131. That's the proof.
The bill should pass. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. there's a long history here, and unless certain members of the committee would like to know it, I would choose not to go into it about Milltown Hill and all the problems we have had down there. Basically, Douglas County has gone through every hoop imaginable to site a dam, and had got to the point of even having ODF&W sign off on it, having National Fisheries Service sign off on it, having everybody in the world sign off on it, except for the State Fish and Wildlife Commission. And the process just plain broke down at that point in time. All this bill does in actuality is ask the commission to go through the process again. That's all it does.
It was quite critical, and it probably hasn't lost that status at all. And we go forward again and plead the case once more before the commission. It was a dam in my district, placed in the right location for the right reason. And we would like to have the discussion one more time here. And it has quite a bit to do, I would say, with any other dam, and I don't care where it is, placed, for whatever reason. Even the Bull Run, that wants another dam for water. So I think we need to have this discussion. We need to go forward if we're going to place dams in the uplands for the right reason. So the chair certainly supports this.
Are you ready for a motion, Mr. Chair?
I am ready for a motion.
I would move House Bill 3131 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Morgan moves House Bill 3131 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Merkley.
I don't believe we've had public testimony on this bill, have we?
Not public testimony.
Are we going to open this up for people to testify or doesn't?
I don't intend to. We had it last session, and as I stated, the county and the state talked about it. Everybody knows the issue. Except for a few questions.
And those of us who are expected to vote on it.
It's perhaps just a little 15-second
analysis
might serve.
Okay.
This is a dam that was supposed to be built by Douglas County as part of a long-range plan that they had for several dams that were located all over the county, and this was in the headwaters of a creek up in the northern part of the county, and was to provide flood mitigation and water for municipal and agricultural and industrial uses and fish habitat. And there was very good data gathered and testimony done that supported all of those kinds of things. It was a cost-sharing situation between the federal government and the county government. It took years and years. I think that the county worked on it for, what would you say, Jeff, 10 years or so they were in the process of designing it and going through the regulatory hoops on it. Got all the way to the very end of it and got to a situation where they needed to get the okay from the ODF&W Commission here in Oregon. The ODF&W staff recommended in favor of allowing them to build the dam without fish mitigation structures on it because of all the fish habitat that was enhanced by the position of it. And the commission voted not to allow that, and so the project died at this point. And what this bill will allow is the commission to reassess that decision. The sad part about this is that the funding picture has changed considerably since then, but it would be a benefit to Douglas County to have this be in a position, if the funding ever became available again, to be able to pull the project off the shelf and bring it into being without having to go again through the whole process.
And a big argument was around fish passage and requiring it or not requiring it. It was never. There was plenty of mitigation, and the mitigation was required. It's a decision that the commission had to
had to make was whether or not it should be required. And, of course, as soon as they required it, the cost of the project went sky high. But there had been a net benefit established through mitigation by the county and all parties involved for net benefit for fish. And it was in the headlands, way above. We would have had the increased water during spawning times and very positive water temperatures. And for all those reasons, it was way beyond net benefit. Net benefit plus, plus, plus. And to see it fail like this was a pretty big disappointment for many of us.
Mr. Chair.
That's Nick Merkley.
Representative Cruz, it's been said that this bill is intended to allow the issue to be reconsidered. Why does it take a bill to have the issue reconsidered? Why can't one simply go back and ask the commission to take another look at the issue?
I think that's what we're doing in a little stronger form. We can ask that. That doesn't mean that they necessarily have to. This would require them to, and we think it's appropriate. To expand a little bit, this passage was not the issue. It was mitigation and the amount of reserve, financial reserve that was going to be required for that mitigation long term was the issue that the county and OGF&W Commission finally could not agree on. And basically the county's position, Douglas County already has several impoundment projects that they have done without state funds, certainly with federal funds, and they are in a position of almost being to the point of being able to self-fund impoundments just because of the volume of impoundments they have done. And even with that, we are still a water poor county. For us to be able to develop economically or in any way, shape, or form, for us to be able to move out of just a timber-based economy at all, we need water impoundment. So this is vital, a vital link in the ability of Douglas County to survive, bottom line. And the last two impoundments that we did were in the southern part of the county. The northern part of the county certainly has just as much need as the southern part of the county, and if this one falls apart, the ability for Douglas County to sustain itself in the future becomes very, very bleak.
Mr. Chair, I think the we have obviously several people on this panel who are very familiar with this. I want to note, however, that the process of public hearing is the process by which we hear from the public and hear the alternative visions, because as we know, there's often many viewpoints on a piece of legislation, and I would certainly, it sounds like a very logical thing to pursue. It's not clear to me why it was turned down at all. It's not completely clear to me what framing it in this manner has as a practical effect. And both for that and to any of the public that might have come to share their viewpoints, I would appreciate the opportunity for those folks to present their thoughts.
We have a work session, and I appreciate that. And I imagine there's another bill here you'd like the same, and I will give you some time on that particular bill. There's two members here on the committee, their particular bill, and I'm not going to sacrifice time on this particular one. It's a simple message for that one. You can have your choice. You can converse with Devlin and Kafori over that one.
Mr. Chair, I won't engage in making that choice. I think the principle of a public hearing is a profound part of our democracy, and I'd like to be able to vote for this bill, but if the chair wishes to
support it in the session, or if you have someone specifically you would like
to... No, I don't. I mean, there probably is nobody here to testify on it since it hasn't been listed as a public hearing.
Is there anyone else? Any questions?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The issue is new to me. I've been here. This is my fourth question It's the first time I've served on this committee, and it's the first time I've had this issue before me. So it doesn't serve my vote very well to not be better informed. And since it is a bill that speaks to an agency, I wondered if that agency might at least make a statement.
I don't think we have anyone from the commission here. If they do, they can come out.
May I ask the question, Mr. Chair? It seems the intent upon reading it as legislation is to waive the requirement for a fish way as long as there's alternative mitigation that's been worked out. But it doesn't address the part that Representative Cruz spoke to when he said the fish passage was not the issue, it was the amount of the reserve. Is this, so my question would be, if the alternative mitigation plan is worked out, but it still requires some reserve monies in conjunction with the mitigation, would this bill negate the ability of the commission to do that?
No, that is, when we talk about mitigation conditions, that is part of the condition.
Okay, thank you.
Any further discussion? Clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye. No.
A regretful no.
Aye.
No.
Aye. And with the required number of votes, House Bill 3131 passed the floor through past recommendations. We close the work session on House Bill 3131 and we open a work session on House Bill 2874 and 2875. I think Representative Simmons that was just here wanting to give testimony real quick. We had I think we got amendments coming through. Trustee Simmons, it's all yours. We're on, I open work session on both of those, 2874 and 2875. Do you have any, does the department come up too? You can give testimony.
If you call them up, we'll be happy to come up.
I'll have them come up after you're done.
This is the Elgin pork bill.
Yeah, but that was on with that.
What are we doing for Elgin today?
Well, if the offer's open, I'd be happy to list quite a number of things, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am State Representative Mark Simmons, chief sponsor of House Bill 2874 and 2875. Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing these bills today. On 2874, you have an amendment before you that basically guts and stuffs the bill. We did have a meeting with ODFW to make some decisions about what kind of predator population study or experimental study could be implemented in the Blue Mountain Hunt Zone of Northeast Oregon. And you should have some -3 amendments to 2874 before you, and we have stricken the bears from the bill. There are no harvest quotas established currently for bears, however there are for cougar, and so we limited it in this bill to the cougar portion, and we expect to see some result over a number of years, over a 5-year period, and see some increased numbers of ungulates, deer and elk, in that area of Northeast Oregon. I'm confident that at least some kind of data should be able to produce based upon that study. We have to answer any questions about the DASC amendments to House 1574.
Question? Trustee Simmons, are they able to do this within the present planning hour?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It was anticipated that within current budget, they would be able to implement this.
That's improved.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Simmons. Why are we restricting this to the Green Mountain Hunt Zone?
We've had some, Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, tremendous reductions in deer and elk numbers in that area. And
I guess my problem is that we're seeing reductions elsewhere too. And I understand you're part of the tip part of the state currently, so it's just a function of time before everybody else is seeing the same impact. And I guess my concern is that you are getting a remedy where Southern Oregon may also be in need of remedy in the not too distant future.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I recognize that, and there are certain places in Northeast Oregon that are hit harder than others, and populations that were once healthy and thriving now are just a shadow of their former selves. And I do recognize also that there are potentially problems in other areas of the state, and I'm hoping that we can get this pilot program implemented and hopefully be able to see some kind of data forthcoming that will allow us to make some decisions elsewhere in the state.
Mr. Chair, I'm not opposed to the bill. I just wanted on the record that this is not unique to Blue Mountains, that the rest of the state is being impacted by the increase in Cougar population as well.
Mr. Chair, I'll just put on the record that my district has no cougars at all.
Would you like some?
Is there anyone else who wanted to speak on this?
Mr. Chair, could we hear from the department?
I had no one else sign up to no, Mr. Chair.
Joe?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I'm the assistant to the director of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. With me today is Rich Berry, our chief of wildlife division. We've been working with Representative Simmons on this amendment to this bill. We believe that there is that we can do something with this study as he has amended this bill for this very small area of the Blue Mountains. We'd also like to point out that we did recommend that we do a more detailed, scientifically based population study of the relationship between ungulates or deer and elk and bears and cougars as their predators. That study would cost about $1 million during the next biennium to do. So we've worked with Representative Simmons to come up with something that we feel is a good study. It'll give us some information. It may not be as scientifically credible study that we'd like it to be, but we do believe that we can find some information with a study.
Joe, have you done some similar things? I know I've talked with you when we had the meeting with Representative Sending and others, but you've done some similar things just to gain information for the department.
I'd have to defer to like Chief of Wildlife here, Rich Berry.
Chair Welch, members of the committee, my name is Rich Berry. I'm the Wildlife Division Director. We've not taken to this course where we try to reduce the number of, in this case, cougars to try to determine the effect. What we have in some of our studies is with our tags, our collared animals that we have, and then we know what the sport harvest or some of the other harvest methods have been, what that has done. But we've not looked at it in this manner where we would purposely go out and try to reduce the numbers within a particular area.
Okay. Other questions?
I'm sorry to ask a question because I can't remember from the long hearing that we had last time. On line 15 of the amendment, it talks about using jobs in some of the program, and I thought that ODFW already had the ability to use dogs when they were trying to do some of the
mature and Griffin Safari. We wanted to make sure it was explicit to this pilot program that the authorizations are explicitly for this pilot program.
That's
okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recall from the testimony that we did have described to us a number of cougars that had been killed by the department as a with hounds as a result of complaints about cougars. Does this measure enlarge the allowed taking of cougars beyond those that are complaints of the object of a complaint?
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Taylor, the department sets quotas. Every year they set quotas for how many cougars they think they can reasonably take in a given area. In this case, it's the Blue Mountain Hunt Zone. And what this study just asks is that that quota be met every year. Without the use of hounds, it's been difficult to meet the quota.
Okay. Mr. Chair, how large is this Blue Mountain Hunt Zone?
Representative Murphy, the Hunt Zone is the northeast portion of the state. It's covered, I just don't have my map here, the key elements would be 5 counties, I believe it is, the northeast portion of the state.
Roughly a quarter of the state?
Yeah. Right.
I can follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, follow up.
Essentially, that in that portion of the state, whatever that size it is, we're reestablishing hunting more or less as it was before the initiative passed and the use of hounds.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Mr. Merkley, no. Only the state agents or federal agents or volunteers authorized by them to implement the study would be the only ones that could be out there taking cougar.
Representative Mark, if I may add to that, as you recall the testimony we gave to you earlier, that cougar tag sales, we actually lowered the price on those tag sales. We saw a tremendous jump from about 980 to over 10,000. What this does, we have, as an example, in that area, we had a quota set of 86 animals that we felt could be harvested within our harvest guidelines. What we have harvested to date in there is 58 animals, so we have not made our total quota. What this would allow is that we may see them all being harvested by the increased recreational harvest. As you recall, the graph that I pointed out to you before was that the recreational harvest is starting to climb very rapidly. It may mean that they may end up taking the quota through the recreational harvest. If not, then we may look at some other means trying to increase that harvest.
Sure.
Lieutenant Cruz.
I move the Daftrey Amendment to House Bill 2874.
Lieutenant Cruz moves the Daftrey Amendment to House Bill 2874.
Conceptually amended. That's conceptually amended. As conceptually amended by, well, that I move the ending gross statutory amendment to House Bill 2874. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Okay. That's Ms. Cruz moves the hand gross statutory amendment to House Bill 2874. Further discussion.
Mm-hmm. I just like to observe that I appreciate the beer being taken out. I do have those in my gift.
So noted. Okay. Any opposition? There are none, so accepted.
I move House Bill 2874 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Stephanie Cruz moves House Bill 2874 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 No.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Having required member votes, House Bill 2874 has to be floor with a due pass recommendation. And we're still open on the work session on 2875.
We go on the road.
Go ahead, Joe.
Mr. Chair, I gave the only copy of a typed out.
Oh, conceptual. This is left dash two. You just wanted to. Okay.
You're saying in addition to the dash two, is that Simmons?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Again, this is Representative Mark Simmons for the record. Northeast Oregon District 58, chief sponsor of House Bill 2875. What we did here, Mr. Chair, is clarify in statute that a person may take a cougar that poses a threat to public safety. And you have the dash two amendments before you, and the typewritten sheet. It starts off, a person may take a cougar that poses a threat to public safety, is intended to replace Section 3 of the Dash 2 Amendment. It clarifies a few criteria. A cougar poses a threat to public safety if the cougar exhibits little or no fear of people, displays aggressive behavior when in contact with people, crouches, advances, or snarls at a person, or is repetitively sighted during the day around people. This isn't nearly as far, Mr. Chair, as I would like to take this bill, but this does represent a compromise that clarifies that when there is danger to humans, people should be able to act on that and do what is needed to keep themselves or their loved ones from becoming prey. And so I bring you the dash two amendment and with the added language that the request that it be conceptually amended into the bill.
Sure.
So you're eliminating any reference to the use of dogs in Section 3.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is correct. We're eliminating any reference to use of dogs in Section 3, actually, and the Measure 18 language that is in the statute. I believe it's 198.164. It references a set of exceptions where
a person is allowed to use bait or dogs to take cougar and bear their, in accordance with the provisions of ORF 498.012, this would be added to that as another provision wherein the use of bait or dogs by a person would that they would be allowed to take a cougar that was posing a threat to public safety.
So section 3 is a new section, but we delete the dash 2 wording and insert this other?
Correct.
Okay.
We delete the section 3 of the dash 2.
We do need...
And insert this other wording.
We do need a correction. I think it's not couches, isn't it crouches?
Mr. Chair, we looked that up just a few moments ago down LC, and couching is hiding in ambush.
Is it? Okay.
And preparing.
I thought it was somebody sat on in your living room.
There was, we did want to clarify that. We wondered if there was a typo here.
Okay. Couching is what we want.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
President Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to be argumentative, but I kind of like 2 and 3 and see, though, if a cougar approached me displaying aggressive behavior or couched, advanced, or snarled, I would consider that a threat. But I tell you the truth, number 1 and number 4, I don't see as very threatening. Mm-hmm. Just being repetitively sighted during the day or exhibiting little or no fear, that might just be peaceful coexistence, mightn't it?
Mr. Sharon.
I really do think Representative Taylor needs to speak to this.
We'll talk to the department after.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, Representative Taylor. It's natural for cougars to be fearful of people. We are not their natural prey. However, they have not been pursued by a houndsman for some time now, and they are losing their fear of humans and coming to town. And not being afraid is only the next step before it's dinner. And repetitively sighted during the day around people, cougars are naturally nocturnal. If they're having a hard time finding something to eat, you'll see them around the daytime, is my understanding.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Kapoor.
Any one of you fine gentlemen could explain for me how this is how this differs from current law, because I thought the story that we heard about the people who took the cougars that were in their yards, I thought you could do this already.
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, technically you're supposed to get a permit, call and get a permit, and you can, gentlemen can correct me. We would like to see a uniform application of the policy towards how cougars in these situations are to be handled. And I believe that it is in good faith with those who, maybe I'm speaking out of turn here, but in my way of thinking, it keeps faith with Measure 18. If we can prevent hostile interaction between cougars preying on people by allowing people to take care of a problem should it arise without having to get on the phone and get permission first. I think that it's in our best interest and in the best interest of those who even want to end hound and bait.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
ma'am.
This as written doesn't make any distinction between cougars coming into people's yards and cougars one encounters in the wild, or am I misreading it? Perhaps the context changes that.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Merkley, the large number of encounters are in people's yards or near their homes. The greater number of encounters are there. Much fewer number of encounters out in the wild. If you saw a cougar run across the road in front of you, obviously this wouldn't apply. If you're out driving along a forest road and one ran across the road in front of you, obviously this wouldn't apply. But what we are concerned about is their interaction with humans, and we struggle with the language, quite frankly. And this is the compromise language that we were able to develop.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Joe Rollator, the assistant to the director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I just want to reinforce, this is basically what we're doing now. This language is in our Cougar Management Plan of 1993. We sought this compromise because we want to make it very clear to everybody what our rules are about dealing with cougars that are a threat to public safety. We're not attempting to have open season on every cougar that walks through everybody's yard, but we do want to make it very clear that if you feel that there is a public threat, you can take that cougar.
Okay, any other questions? Appreciate the input here.
Sure. I move the conceptual amendments to the last two amendments to House Bill 2875, which would replace Section 3, lines 10 and 11 in the last two amendments with a person may take a cougar that poses a threat to public safety. A cougar poses a threat to public safety if the cougar, one, exhibits little or no fear of people, two, displays aggressive behavior when in contact with people, three, couches, advances, or smells at a person, or four, is repetitively sighted during the day around people.
Thank you. That's approved. That's approved. Move to conceptual amendment on the actual amendment here, which would delete the present language in Section 3 and replace it with the one that we have typed out here that you so eloquently described for
you. Kind of
okay. Any further discussion? No. Listening, Devin.
Mr. Chairman, as I often do, I will be voting for the amendments because I think it makes it a better bill, but I will be voting no when we get to the motion.
Opposition? Hearing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
I move the draft to amend it as conceptually amended the House Bill 2875.
That's approved, Ms. Dash, two amendments to House Bill 2875 as conceptually amended. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair,
Captain Muffler.
I'll be voting against the bill. Reading from the Oregonian inmate. No, that's David Scott Fulcher. 1860? No, I don't think so. February 10th, 1997. And it notes that the Department of Fish and Wildlife are given by Major 18 authority to track down problem cougars with how to protect public health and safety. I think that that was an important balance, and I've stated that I would support efforts to increase our ability to respond quickly to communities and families that have difficult specific cougars. In this case, though, I feel this goes a little too far. It doesn't specify that the cougars are encroaching on a community. It applies to any cougar found anywhere. And we have testimony from experts that were distributed that a couple of these folks who had studied cougars for 10 years recited many, many instances where cougars would charge them and then retreat and disappear, or they were never attacked, if you will, but charging was basically a statement of don't fool with me, and often they noted it means that they have cubs nearby. And I have to agree with Representative Taylor that just the prospect of exhibiting no fear is a very subjective. On a bike ride a couple of years ago where we went around a corner and there was a cougar. It didn't exhibit any fear, but I don't think that that's the case, that the basis that we should be able to shoot it. And so I think a more finely tuned effort to reinforce the safety and public health issues that we've had and with livestock is important to the compromise that's been struck in the state. But as I read it, this is pretty much, I'm trying to envision a situation in which one couldn't justify shooting a cougar, and it's hard for me to find. I do see that this as basically a direct attack on Measure 18, and I support it.
Appreciate that. Any other discussion? That's it, Gina.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'll be voting yes because we heard testimony about family pets and the danger of going out and you know, getting the pet that they thought was dead, and they had to take a gun to protect themselves, and all the situations and all the testimony we heard of the dangers, and there really is a need for this bill, both of these bills, in that particular area where they live and where their families are in danger. So I'll be voting yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Any more? Hearing none. Any opposition? They had a little bit there, but we have enough. So let's go move.
I move House Bill 2875 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor with the DPAS recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2875 as conceptually amended and amended to the floor with the DPAS recommendation. Any further discussion? Representative Cruz.
I find it amazing, Mr. Chair, that the only correspondence I have had in opposition to this bill and the previous one are those who live in Portland and never have to deal with Cougars.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I indicated, I'll be voting the bill itself, but I did want to comment on a couple of items. One is that the testimony that we received indicated that the Cougar population was growing before Measure 18 and continues to grow, but all of the discussion that we've had, and I want to comment on the all the proponents of this measure that I'm understanding why they're bringing the measure forward, but it points out to me in a sense why I think it's difficult in issues like this to impose solutions by initiative, because I think there are some issues that need to be addressed here. I'm just caught between representing my district and trying to find a solution that's acceptable to this. The other thing is, there's a portion of this that we often talk about getting rid of quote-unquote problem cougars, is that somehow we kept dossiers on each cougar and identified them down to, you know, what their behavior patterns were. I don't really think that that's possible. I think sooner or later the state will have to find a solution to this. I don't really think we're at the point yet with these bills. I wish Mr. Simmons and the other proponents well in their efforts, and I'll be voting no.
Mr. Chair, I'll surprise many of my caucus members by supporting this measure. I don't see it as a rollback of the initiative that was passed. When I talked this over with hunters, I know, they didn't feel that it was much different for the sports population to be able to be allowed to hunt these particular problem critters than for the department to do it with volunteers. So I know that opportunities for hunting have decreased in many areas, and so I don't see this as a rollback of the initiative, and for that reason I can support it.
Any other comments? Well, I certainly support this effort too, and I think it is our responsibility to do everything we can for the public safety, whether we're camping or whether it's close to our home or whether it's for our livestock, wherever. I think this certainly is the effort, and there's been a number of hours working with the department and the proponents of this legislation and trying to come up with something that, and a little bit of, I know in the other bill with some research too, something to base some of these decisions on, help our legislation make some decisions in the future. So I think it's a good movement here, and I really hope we do not experience any life that is taken or injury like other states have here due to a cougar. And I think that's our responsibility, doing everything we can here to provide the tool. And we're just doing that. I appreciate support for this. Clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
Yes. And having the required number of votes, House Bill 2875 as amendment passed through 4-2 pass recommendation. We need carry for 2874 and 2875. Do you want to carry both?
Be fine.
Representative Simmons is carry for both bills. Thank you very much. I close the work session on the House Bill 2874 and 75. And we open a work session on House Bill 3393. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're before you again. This is Elaine Hoffman, State Representative from District 2. And we're bringing before you a bill that we hope will help people who are dealing with what we lovingly call LWD, large woody debris. And we had some concerns and questions that came forward at the last hearing that we had. And I might also mention that the amendments that you see before you and the ones that were brought up and the ideas brought up before only the tip of the iceberg in regards to what has really happened on this bill. The work that has been done by various agencies and people to come up with something that we feel is workable to solve this problem could fill several reams and several notebooks which we indeed had. And I would like to now turn over an explanation of some of those to my esteemed colleague here who will run through some of the changes that we have finally come up with.
For the record, my name is Ken Beerley. Today I'm representing the Governor's Natural Resource Office. State agencies have been discussing this issue for some time, and it arises out of the fundamental issue that you need to get a permit, and the landowner who's trying to improve fish habitat in the state of Oregon needs to get a permit to place large wood in the stream to improve fish habitat. However, anyone can come along and take that out for firewood without any public review, and it is a conundrum of that creates frustration. And we're trying to develop an approach that would be have as minimal impact on the regulatory system as well as on landowners who are trying to improve fish habitat and streams. We do not have all the language worked out on this matter. We would like to have this bill passed out so that we can resolve it between now and the time of the Senate, and we would commit to working in that regard with all the persons that are who are affected by this proposed issue, by this issue.
Yeah, I'd like to just add to that a little bit. This is the result of working together with a lot of different people who normally might not get together, and it's come a long way from the beginning. The latest version of it answers some questions and some concerns that people had at the Farm Bureau and some of the Water Resources Congress. I don't want to leave anybody out. We have had a large list of people involved in the process of making this come to this point. And so far, as far as I know, everybody's pretty much on board and would like to continue it and fine-tune it as necessary to make sure that all the pieces and parts come together in the end. Appreciate the fact that you brought it back to the committee for a work session. And between the three of us, maybe we could answer any questions you might have.
I think there's some others that want to talk on this too that I was going to allow here that had requested and had talked to me ahead of time too. So, but I'll open up for questions. Is there any other questions here from the committee?
How much more do you anticipate is going to have to be done here?
I think that the Department of Forestry had some questions about some procedures, and we had to go, everybody involved had to go a little bit further in giving of, you know, than they had originally wanted to ensure. And I'm not real sure how much farther we have to go. I think what it does is answering the call of the people who've had problems. I know you mentioned that you had some people in your district who had lost property, both land and structure. And there are people in Representative Hopkins' district who have lost land and almost a structure. And one of them was those large power poles that CPNL had moved once, and after one more event from the time they moved, which cost them about $25,000 $30,000 to literally put new poles 30 feet away, they were dangling in the water. And so some emergency work had to be done, and the Division of State Lands was very cooperative and willing to help on that one. But a lot of it is that a lot of people are unsure what they can and can't do. And in that case, that was an emergency, and it just alleviates the process that's in place right now, that we didn't want to have to go the long route in an emergency of having to get a permit and have it signed off, and in the meantime, you're losing property, and it's threatening. And I guess in a short version of it, what it would do, as described by Mr. Barley, is there's a piece of wood in the river. And it doesn't even include, we've taken out everything else, like the channel pitches, dam structures, and that was in answer to a -1 amendment by Pacific Power, CGE, and Bob Hall had. One of the things that he had concerns with in the Water Congress was that these places have expensive structures, and their water works and their power equipment that would be damaged, and there's no time to get a permit to remove something if it's going to be damaged. So it allows that. I'm not sure what else at this point.
Mr. Chair, I have a problem. We are now putting in statute the definition of waters of the state. Explain that.
Representative Welch, Representative Cruz, this does not change the definition of waters of the state that currently exists.
Well, then why is it in black print?
Which version do you have?
Black print denotes new language.
Mm-hmm. Representative Welch, Representative Cruz, the -3 is explicitly included. I'm sorry, I was incorrect in my first response. The -3 amendments exclude from waters the state for the purpose of defining large woody debris, channels, industrial, municipal, or domestic water systems, and other similar facilities constructed by humans. In response to the request from Portland General Electric about concerns to address their specific issues and others similar to that.
Maybe I'm mistaken. I mean, we have had debates for years over what's included in waters of the state. Is that different from waters of this state?
Representative Welch, Representative Cruz, this is a proposed amendment to current language about waters of the state, and it would restrict the authority to deal with large wood from specific sites that are artificially created or created by human beings.
But the question is, what is the difference between waters of the state and waters of this state?
To my knowledge, nothing.
Do we have a definition of waters of the state?
In the original bill, which takes off of ORS 196-800, would be an exception Well, line 17 of the bill, section 15, waters of this state means natural waterways, including all tidal and non-tidal bays, intermittent streams, constantly flowing streams, lakes, wetlands, and other bodies of water in this state, navigable and non-navigable, including that portion of the Pacific Ocean which is in the boundaries of the state. And what you're talking about, can you see that one again?
Representative Cruz, for the record, Ken Beerley, the Governor's Natural Resource Office. There are definitions for waters of the state or waters of this state in at least four sections of statute. The Department of Forestry has a definition of waters of the state. The Department of Environmental Quality has a definition of waters of the state. The Division of State Lands has a definition of waters of the state, as does the Water Resources Department. Each one of those has a specific legislatively defined definition of waters of the state.
And it's always this state?
And I do not know whether it is this state or the state in each instance. It seems like it's a difference without a distinction without a difference.
I guess that would be my question. So to the degree we are putting another definition, similar or dissimilar, in another part of GLRF.
The purpose of this specific language was to exempt certain areas where there are human structures likely impacted from these large wood placements.
Can your knowledge, you say there are currently four different definitions in statute depending on which agency you're talking about. Are they dissimilar or are you familiar enough to know that?
Representative Cruz, there have been legal arguments about the similarity and dissimilarity between those definitions. Some are very specific for specific purposes. For example, Water Resources Department's definition of waters of the state is quite broadly construed and includes a lot of irrigation conveyances, those kinds of things where there are waters that are diverted to spill in their jurisdiction. The differences between the Department of Environmental Quality and the Division of State Lands have been debated in other regulatory instances. There haven't been major differences other than how the generic statutes are applied.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Morgan.
Would it be a reasonable solution to this to add in some language that said for the purposes of this statute, waters of the state should be defined as, or some kind of limiting device?
I think you'll hear Jan Lee come and testify. There were some changes made in response to her request regarding that issue. But that's I don't know the law that clearly to differentiate between the four different definitions.
Well, we do know, though, that we're going to have a little more work here on this, right?
Mr. Chair, I guess, and thank you for pointing out on page 2 of the original bill, lines 17 through 20 are basically the same language as lines 8 through 12 to the trends on the DAS 3, so obviously that should not have been dark print, which would have simplified a whole lot of things for me.
Maybe not.
Cruz, I believe for drafting purposes, since they did exclude the A, B, and C, they included the entire paragraph. So if you look at the dash 3, it's that except it excludes channels, industrials, and any other similar facilities. So they included the entire definition of the park print.
Any other questions here? Because I want to just go back to the work group again and then hammer a few more things out here if we could. I think we will see that. I don't know if I'm moving on, but I think we're going to maybe we do just a little more work. There's a couple other people like to have on here. So. Thanks. Jean Wilkinson? Okay.
Chairman Welsh, members of the committee, I'm Jean Underhill-Wilkinson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Unfortunately, I've not been involved with the work group that's been dealing with this bill, but I fully anticipate and would like to participate in that work group if they need again to work out a few concerns. We represent, Cattlemen's Association represents landowners across the state who are dealing with stream restoration issues to a large degree nowadays. And we have a concern about a policy statement in here. I'd just like to share that with you. Under Section 1, the policy statement under 2, it says the Legislative Assembly finds that a stable stream with a variety of large woody debris creates quality habitat that benefits fish and wildlife as well as general watershed health. We represent a lot of landowners who are doing stream restoration work in areas that don't naturally have large woody debris. I'm not a scientist, but I have received training in proper functioning condition assessment, and in fact, we put on workshops to teach landowners about that assessment process, and I assist in those. Large woody debris may indeed create some quality habitat for fish and other wildlife, but systems where large woody debris does not exist, we really have to weigh whether installing large woody debris, whether the risks associated with that are perhaps balanced with the benefits that it could give. I don't think it's a good idea for us to statutorily imply that large woody debris is needed in order for us to have good quality habitat for fish and wildlife. And certainly, I don't think it's a good idea for us to statutorily advocate for one tool in watershed restoration over the other. I think that our systems are complex enough and our watershed systems are diverse enough that in restoration we really need to look at all of our tools that we can use and decide based on that locality what tools are best to use. And perhaps large woody debris is not the preferable tool in some systems. I would suggest that perhaps you want to move the bill out of committee today and we work on it a little bit more. Otherwise, I would suggest that either that policy statement be deleted or amended with a phrase that would say after the word debris, you could say separate a short phrase by commas that says on streams where large wood naturally exist would take care of the concern that I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Questions? Okay, I think we could bring it back. We could schedule on Friday if you just work out a few details. It might work for them. Someone else want to give testimony? Is there anyone else here? Jan Lee?
I'm Jan Lee with the Oregon Water Resources Congress, and the Dash 3 amendments take care of all of the problems that we previously had with the bill. We were concerned that currently we don't need a permit under DSL to deal with the maintenance of our facilities around reservoirs, and this amendment makes it very clear that people who operate those kind of diversions will be able to remove woody debris without calling someone, without a fine, et cetera. We're concerned not only about our structures in general, but if one of the structures were taken out, people would be without irrigation water for some period of time while the correction occurred. The other thing that we had asked for in the amendments was a change in the definitions of waters of the state, and that is only for the purpose of this particular section of the law. Actually, if the word this was removed and the was put in its place, Section 1B would read the same as the General Division of State Lands definition. What we asked to be added was that the language in Section 1, large A, B, and C, which relates to man-made construction, would not be defined as waters of the state for a purpose of this act. I think that just about takes care of.
Would you repeat that one more time again?
Oh, yes. For the purposes of this bill, just for this section of the law and not for other agencies or other areas of division of state land, we requested that lines 14 through 17 of the Dash 3 amendment be added so that no artificial canals or structures would be dealt with. And the other question then was liability. We feel that the landowners, timber owners, and others who are trying to provide this woody debris in stream should not be held responsible for liability, and we concur with that. We are assuming that the way the amendments are written and the original bill was written, that the state takes on that liability, because we wouldn't be happy if no one took it on and some of our structures were taken out. But the way I read it, the state does assume that liability, as they do with other watershed programs.
Does it get general thumbs up over here? Okay. All right. Maybe the conceptuals aren't that bad. We could go ahead here. I'm just looking at with the Gene's recommendations here. And with Jan, everyone's here. I read that the biggest change here would be that we take care of the legislative assembly findings down here by on line 19. We would insert after woody debris on streams where large wood naturally exists. Put something in there, right there, and conceptually, and move this on. I think we, and then with the waters of the state, on that, all right? Okay. I think that's all we captured, women. That's not so bad.
Good.
I think I'd be willing to move on.
Just a comment that from the testimony that we've gotten in the Salmon Committee and in this committee together, there is a big need for this, a policy like this to be on the books to deal with this problem that we're creating as we're trying to save these fish. And so I would not be opposed at all to making the amendments conceptually and moving it along.
The chair will move the conceptual here. I'll just go through it real quick here, and then we'll move the rest of it. Now, as we've seen the dash 3, we're conceptually on line 8, where it reads waters of the state, it will be waters of the state. Line 12, the same, waters of the state will be waters of the state. And we move down to line 19. And after debris, we will insert on the streams where large wood naturally exists. And then we'll continue with the rest of that line. And we will ask that that be conceptually submitted.
Yes, Representative Welch, when you're talking about waters of the state, what you might preface that with is for the purposes of the 99 Act, that would make it explicit, but for the purposes of this Act and for this policy, therefore, it doesn't apply to all definitions that that's applied to.
Would that work right on line 5 for the purposes of this Act? Would that be
line 8, I believe?
Or would you
it
say?
It would be up to the bracketed small b on line 8.
Yeah, that would work, sure.
That would be fine.
Okay. All right. That's on line 8 then. For the purposes of this 1990 Act. 1999. You want to make this up, 1999 Act, okay? And we will successfully amend on line 8 there. Okay? Any discussion here? Okay. Any opposition? Hearing none, so moved.
Chair,
Representative Cruz.
I move the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3393 as conceptually amended.
Representative moves the House Bill, dash 3 amendments as conceptually amended to House Bill 3393. Any further discussion? Hearing none, any opposition? Hearing none, so moved.
Chair, I move House Bill 3393 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor with the DPAC recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 3393 as conceptually amended and amended in the dash 3 to the floor with the DPAC recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative Atkinson.
Aye.
Representative Dillon?
Aye.
Representative
Floyd?
Aye.
Representative Murphy?
Aye.
Representative Murphy?
Aye.
Representative
Taylor?
Aye.
And Representative Sherwell? Aye. Having required number of votes, House Bill 3393 as amended has to floor to do pass recommendation. Anterior. Representative Hobson, would you like to carry this? Thank you very much. Representative Hobson is the carrier. Thank you. Okay, we close the work session on 3393 and we'll open the work session on House Bill 3280. And Director Pagel, Burton Weiss, and anyone else invited, please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Burton Weiss, on behalf of the Oregon Fire District Directors Association. We have dash two amendments that I hope the committee has. Christina says yes. You'll recall on this bill, this replaces, these amendments replace the content of the original 3280 and replace it to deal with the issue of getting water for fire training. Remember, the statute currently allows fire departments to take water for emergency firefighting, but there was no provision for taking water for fire training.
You mean dash one, two?
No, dash twos.
Okay.
The dash one amendments were the...
Well, no wonder we got one. We got one to share, you know.
He's holding
the Xerox stock guy on. I'm trying to help him. You will recall the dash one amendment simply added non-emergency firefighting training, or firefighting training rather, in the dash one's amendment to the list of folks who were exempt from getting any kind of water permits or otherwise. And Director Pagel expressed concern to the committee that that would allow on a non-emergency basis, that might allow departments to take water from resource areas or endangered streams or situations like that, which was not the intent. And the chair directed Director Pagel and myself to go out and try to work out some amendments. And what you have before you are those amendments. Under the amendments, non-emergency firefighting training conducted by fire departments and rural fire protection districts would be allowed, provided that the source of water is existing storage, which is the ponds we talked about, and that they have the permission of the owner, which departments do, which they do get for that, or that if the source of water is other than existing storage, in other words, a stream, that the use occurs with the prior written approval of the water master in the district where the training will take place, which is actually good for us. I hate to admit that Martha had a great idea, but that is actually good for us because we don't want to throw a hose inadvertently in a stream that's got an endangered species or something in it and wind up with a huge fine from NIMS or some other state agency.
You have trouble finding a stream if
that's true. Yeah. So all this does is mean we have to, before we, and these sites, if you'll recall, are identified. We map the sites where we take water for fire. And so all this requires that we go see the water master if it's a stream to make sure we're not taking water out of a place where we shouldn't. So there is one problem with the amendments, and we can deal with them on the other side, considering we're running out of time here. It's not a huge problem. But the way our intention was is that emergency firefighting as an exempt use would remain an exempt use subject to no conditions, and that it was the non-emergency training that would be subject to these conditions. The way the amendments are written, it requires both emergency and non-emergency to follow these conditions. It's a pretty simple change. I think all we have to do is make a D out of non-emergency firefighting and move that down, but we've discussed it and we know the committee's schedule and everything else, and if you wish, we can deal with that on the Senate side.
Okay. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, it seems like it would be fairly easy. I mean, it's elimination. We could do that conceptually.
If that's the committee, we'd be happy.
The exclusion of emergency firefighting, then it's the statute, then all we're doing is adding.
A B.
Yeah, adding a B.
So you just do, you'd eliminate the word and in line 8 and put a sub B in front of non-emergency firefighter training.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And move it down, and that's all you need to do.
Mm-hmm. And then it would need to be re-lettered down below.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Then, yeah. Then everything below that changes too.
And then, yeah, B on line 18 would become C, and then
right.
Mm-hmm.
So forth. So it's not a difficult.
Would you just remove on line 8 A, emergency firefighting uses altogether? That's the current statute, and if it's not there, it exists as it currently is. Correct?
Well, you'd have to leave that in.
I'm sorry. Why would you have to leave that in?
Hearing what we said would be the clearest and simplest way to do it.
Yeah, have to start
you need to leave that in there under 537.141. You need that in the sub A for firefighting, and I think you need that in
there. It's an unamended case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so currently that A is simply emergency firefighting uses. That's
correct.
It?
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
And
a
semicolon.
Okay.
And then
the semicolon, and then it would drop down to B, non-emergency firefighting, and then the rest stays the same, and then on 18, B becomes C, and...
Mm-hmm.
And on, if the committee is willing, we would appreciate that.
Simplify things on the other side, wouldn't
it? Yeah. I'd rather send it over there that way.
Not worthy.
We might have to amend it again.
As much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
President Tino.
I just had a question for Mr. Burton. How long does it take to get the permission from the water master?
Chair Welch, Representative Gianelli, I don't think we don't perceive that to be a major issue. It's just going in and checking with them. The way it works, and the chief can explain it too if he chooses, the way it works is for training purposes, we identify the site that we take water from. In other words, we just don't drive out and look for water when you're doing training. You identify the sites you're going to train from, and we already have those on maps. So all we have to do is take those maps into the water master and say, here's our identified site. Are there any of these sites that cause a problem? And if there isn't, we can get them signed off. The water masters are local. Our local folks doesn't require us to go to Salem. We can go to the county courthouse. And fire folks we talked to didn't think this was an unreasonable restriction or anything that would take any appreciable time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. I'd just like to take exception to Mr. Reese's surprise that Martha would have good ideas. She's had many good ideas that I've been aware of.
Are we ready to move on next?
Yeah.
I have a question, Chair.
Yes, Mr. Morgan.
I would move to conceptually amend the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3280 on line 8 after the word uses to add a semicolon. Delete the next word and, add a small b bracketed, and then down on line 18 and subsequent small letter subsections to re-letter them so that they were in sequence.
That's Dave Morgan. Those are proposing. Provide the motion to conceptual amend, as stated on line 8, semicolon, delete and and subsequently re-letter these for the remainder through D, which would become E. Okay? It does go further. It goes. Oh, does it? Okay, we'll have
all the way
down. All the way through. Okay. And that way we'll take care of. Have any discussion? Any opposition? And none, so moved.
Chair, I would move the dash 2 amendments as conceptually amended to House Bill 3280.
That's a pretty, Morgan.
Excuse me, I apologize.
Representative Morgan.
Well, that was a slam.
Bill 3280. As conceptually amended to the dash 2 amendments. Do we have any more discussion? Hearing none. Any opposition? Hearing none. So moved.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan.
I would move the conceptually amended, well, I guess I'm going to move House Bill 3280 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor with the DPAS recommendation.
Representative Morgan moves House Bill 3280 as conceptually amended and amended to dash 2 to the House floor with the DPAS recommendation. Any further discussion? Clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. And required number of votes, House Bill 3280 moves to the floor as a minimum conception with a due pass recommendation.
Okay.
Morgan?
Right.
Okay. Representative Morgan will see the carrier. And we will close the work session of this lady. Open a work session on House Bill 3609. And we are just, the chair just asked that we quickly move this on to our Salmon Restoration and SR2 committee. They are waiting for that, but I understand we do have some people that have come here possibly to give some testimony on House Bill 3609. I'm not sure. Anybody raise their hand? Yes, they did.
Well,
you look readily approved.
I move that House Bill 3609 be sent to the SR2 committee.
Salmon Restoration and
Stream Enhancement.
And Stream Enhancement.
No, stop.
Stream Restoration
and Species Recovery.
There we go.
SR2 is the work. SR2.
Stream Restoration and Species Recovery, right? Epson's Cruise moves House Bill 3609 to Stream Restoration and Species Recovery Committee. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, are you moving that without recommendation?
With the realization that four of the signers of the bill are on that committee, I think it'll do okay.
Yeah. Without recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. And the required number of votes, House Bill 3609 passes to Stream Restoration and Species Recovery. Okay. We close the work session in House Bill 3609. I think we have some people to give testimony on House Bill 3500. So we'll open a work session in House Bill 3500. Raise your hand and give testimony on this. Please come forward or raise your hand if there isn't anybody here.
Raise your hand in the front.
Jody Rowan. Would you like to talk about this? And you would like to talk about this? Chair, close the work session. I'm just opening a hearing on this today. Go ahead, Julie.
Representative, I just wanted to say that we have worked with the wording on this a little bit, and we, from how it stands, were comfortable with LCDC's involvement in the rulemaking, and we feel that if we get a well-rounded committee that this could work. So we just wanted to let you know that we're going to be working with LCDC and hopefully getting on their rulemaking committee. The only question that we had is Section 4 of the Act. and that was that this was considered an emergency. And being ignorant of how things work, I just wondered what constitutes an emergency. And so I'm kind of in a position of being a proponent because I think this is a good working solution, but however, this wording here I wasn't unclear on. So I just wanted to let you know that we voiced our opinion on the Section 4, but that we hope we can proceed through and move on. Thank you.
Question from the committee.
Mr. Chair, would the emergency clause on this cause the one-year time frame to kick in right away so that there could be no excuse for dallying on this?
Yeah.
That was the purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the emergency clause just denotes when we ran it takes the clock.
Okay. So, okay.
And so many days after it was passed or signed by the governor? 90 days, whatever it is.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is the other bill that we, that was similar to this, we talked about earlier, the session that has gone away?
Yes, and that's what I wanted everybody to.
And what was that bill for? Yeah.
Bill 2540.
2540?
I believe it's
2549. 2540. And this has been same people working on this as a work group, right? And this is the bill that they've decided that everyone can live with. Okay. Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
That's in my head. Is that a work group that is LCDC now in support of this S3?
Yes. They had a representative from the last meeting that sat in, and they're in agreement that we should come up with some rules that are going to help the kids and still stay in line with coexisting landowners.
Anyone else from the work group want to speak? All right, we've got agreement. Thanks, Joe. Thank you.
You ready for a motion?
No, it's just a public hearing.
I just had this public hearing today. I got a hold off. Yeah. Good moment. Okay, we're closing hearing in Hospital 500. And I will open a hearing on House Bill 3215. I think the foreign devil wants to present some more discussion here.
Mr. Chair, I want to point out to Representative Devlin that his shoes don't match.
I do.
Actually, I get two left and right. They're very comfortable.
Mr. Chairman,
go right ahead, Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to bring this bill back to the committee. What we're doing here today is I'll be presenting to you the -2 amendments. I've been working with the chairs and interested parties to try to come up with a version of this that the committee could support. What we're also trying to do today here is that this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So my basic objective today is to get this hopefully soon into work session and refer it out either with recommendation or without recommendation to Ways and Means. The -2 amendments that I'm proposing for the bill are in order to clarify the original intent behind the bill and narrow the geographic region that is affected. Currently, there are some deficiencies in Oregon's ability to assess public health risks from contaminated fish consumption in the lower portion of the Willamette River. The ability of state agencies to adequately convey risk to the public is also limited. House Bill 3216 would provide funds for the Health Division to hire a toxicologist who would assess current data needs and health risks in order to develop a long-term monitoring program that would measure the level and trend of pollution concentration in water sediment and aquatic tissue. House Bill 3216 would also establish an outreach program in the Health Division that would increase public understanding of the hazards associated with consumption of contaminated fish. While permanent fish advisories are generally posted and temporary problems are typically published in newspapers, barriers such as language and poverty may prevent many of the people who most need to understand the warnings from getting the message. Effective outreach and a greater understanding of rare waters in the region of the Willamette River from the mouth of the Yamhill River north are contaminated are necessary in order to assess and communicate human health risk needs. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, part of the reason in proposing this is that I believe on a very clear basis that, you know, if you look at this state, we have literally dozens, if not hundreds, of rivers. Willamette River, though, is quite a unique river in the sense that it's impacted so greatly by the human impact around it. It serves such a long-term portion of our lives, particularly within the Willamette Valley, relative to commerce, recreation, and other issues. I'd like to point out that one of the reasons that I supported the study that was being presented by Representative Shetterly earlier in this session that had to do with some issues relative to dredging and the potential issues relative to aquatic life with that is that I believe that given the human impacts on the Willamette River, that anything that we can do to better understand our long-term relationship to the river is probably the benefit to the people of the Willamette Valley and to the people of Oregon as a whole. Mr. Chairman, there are also at least three people here to potentially testify, someone from the Department of Health, at least potentially someone from DEQ, and also the OEC would like to testify.
That's interesting.
And let's end up, when you talk about removing the subsequent referral to raise the meeting fee, you have a sum of $150,000 in there.
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, my purpose in appearing here today is to get this moved from hearing to work session so it can be referred to raise the meeting.
All right.
Now, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, obviously my preference would be to send it with a positive recommendation, but if I couldn't get a positive recommendation, my preference would be just to send it to raise the meeting without recommendation.
Is that right, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
On the dash 2, lines 21 through 23, the development of a long-term monitoring program that measures, among other things, the level and trend of pollution, concentration in water sediment, and other aquatic tissue. That would appear to me to be something that is probably more DEQ and would have a rather healthy price tag on it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, my understanding of discussing this with the parties is that one of the reasons why you have this potential impact will be work with the Health Division and DEQ, and some of the toxicology work that needs to be done is some of the most expensive portions of doing carrying out the mission of this particular bill.
So I guess, Mr. Chair, my problem is that we're talking about in relation to sub 2, or lines 21 through 23, and then looking at what we're allocating out of general fund, $150,000, which wouldn't even begin to touch the long-term monitoring program that we're buying into something with an enormous price tag without even really discussing it. I mean, as far as that aspect of it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, in discussions with the chair about this bill, we wanted to approach it from the standpoint of, in a sense, like a pilot, looking at these issues, seeing what could be done. To be honest, future decisions about the long-term nature of this program would depend upon future legislatures and future appropriations. Obviously, going on to Ways and Means, it will compete with a lot of other issues that need to be addressed, and we're just hoping to be able to make that case to Ways and Means.
Follow up. It seems to me the language talking about development of a long-term monitoring program is not appropriate in something that is you're setting up to be a pilot. Pilot isn't necessarily long-term. I mean, I can understand if that would be your ultimate goal, but to put this long-term monitoring program in and then you're going to do a pilot because it's justified. I think you do the pilot because it's justified then you do it. So, but to me, it almost seems like we have the cart before the horse.
Mr. Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, I think what we're trying to do is to spell out in some detail what we're trying to accomplish over the period of this biennium. And part of that was to, you know, look at all the studies that have been done, look at what needs to be done, and then to, in a sense, propose what a long-term monitoring program would be. Because some of the evidence that that we've heard in discussions with the health division is that they have developed a number of fish advisories, but they actually lack the capability to fully carry out their assigned mission in terms of protecting the public health in that area because of limited resources.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you. No.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, would you be happy with on line 21 striking long term and inserting a pilot program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gianella, I would be happy to strike anything that would get this bill on to the But I do not want to open that door to Representative Cruz.
Oh, just for her.
Okay.
You got restricted, Cruz.
Mr. Chair.
President Merkel.
Devlin, refer to, we'll develop a program. Are you talking about designing a program or designing and implementing a program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, the purpose at this point is to do some of the toxicology work that has to be done and to design a program rather than to implement it at this point.
Mr. Kerr.
That's in Gianella.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, would pilot program serve that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gianella, I believe it would at this point.
The health division might sit up and answer questions that might be, I know they want to get to that money. There's some more appropriate questions for them.
Chair Welch, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Johnson, Assistant Administrator for the Oregon Health Division. Our discussions with Representative Devlin, the Department of Environmental Quality, and others were with the notion of developing a design, developing a concept, developing a monitoring program that made sense, that would plug the data gaps that exist at present. As Representative Devlin indicated, there is some data available. We would like to look at that data, see what use it has, and identify the data gaps. As was indicated, in terms of the human health effect and providing advisories or assessing the human health risks associated with contaminants in the river, we don't have enough data right now. The intent of this was to get a toxicologist to do an assessment of what exists, to identify the data gaps, and to put together a concept, a design, a program that would work, that would be then addressed in the future.
So this would be limited to a certain waterway or water bodies within a certain county or counties?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman. It's limited to the lower portion of the Willamette River, which we further defined in the bill, I think, from connection with the Allison announcement. I hope I don't have a representative here. Yamhill River. North, basically.
And this, and your dash twos are amendments to the dash one?
Yes, they are. They replace the dash one.
So we really do have new language all the way through the dash two.
Yes. Sir, Mr. Chairman, the dash twos are further narrowing from the dash one. The dash three system, to be honest, they came from legislative council, I believe, yesterday. They just don't work. The dash threes.
Do we have a dash?
Mr. Chair and committee, can we just have an indulgence and thank Representative Devlin and his excellent staff who brought me up those amendments yesterday, and I could work with them or Friday or whenever I had them. Wonderful. I could engross them. We do have the dashboards in there.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was another copying error. Unfortunately, they're stapled to the back of your
Mr. Chairman, the dash three, we don't feel that the dash three really define what the expenditure is being made for. They were a communication to legislative council. Well, the communication was to, from the dash one to the dash three, was to further narrow the bill. And then the dash three is an attempt to further narrow it, but they put in their attempts to narrow it in the dash three. They eliminated so much of the background for why you would do the bill that there's very little substance left in the bill with the dash three amendment.
But what you're proposing now is just a dash two to the that amendment to the bill. To the bill. Further questions? Others that want to give testimony?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Hillary Abraham with the Oregon Environmental Council, and with me today is Karen Lewatsky, the Director of Water Programs for OEC. We'd like to thank you for bringing this bill back in. As you can see, our testimony is being passed out, and Karen Lewatsky will offer our testimony.
Representative Welch and committee, my name is Karen Lewatsky. For the record, I'm the Oregon Environmental Council. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to bring the bill back. House Bill 3216 is very important to OEC. In particular, we're very, very interested in the public outreach section of this. At this point, the Oregon Health Division does do outreach, but it's a very limited form of outreach because it's not very well funded. The problem we have with the outreach program as it exists is it does not connect with a lot of the people who actually fish the Willamette, particularly the lower Willamette, and consume that fish on a subsistence or on a regular basis. There are signs warning people that the fish are contaminated with mercury. There are signs warning them that they should only eat the fish if it's been treated in a certain way. But we know that people who fish in the slough, where we have TCD-laden fish, are taking those fish back to their communities and selling them to their friends and neighbors. These are people who live on these fish. They're not reading those signs. They don't even speak English. We feel like this outreach component is extremely important. Likewise, we feel that establishing a monitoring program, figuring out what we need to look for and how it needs to be tested for, is very important. We know that we have mercury problems. We know we have PCB problems, but that's because we need to test for those things. There are other things that can be found in fish tissue. The DEQ has done numerous studies on the Willamette River.
Who's done the testing on this?
The testing for, beg your pardon?
The mercury and the PCB.
I'd like to defer that to the health department. Excuse me.
Are there government reports?
There are government reports on that, yes. So the Willamette Basin Task Force also recommended, as a result of these reports, the DEQ, for example, found toxic chemicals and metals in fish tissues above recommended levels. That was in 1997.
They also found dioxins in furan. But as I said, the health division may have further reports for you that they can send you to. The point in beefing up the monitoring program is we've only tested for certain things. That means things we haven't tested for that could be dangerous to human health may be present in those fish tissues. We haven't asked the question. We don't know the answer. Now, this bill does not tell us to do the monitoring. It simply helps establish where the gaps are in our current knowledge. So if we choose to go forward with more monitoring, we do it in a responsible, efficient manner. We work with DEQ and we ask the right questions. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions from the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
That's in GNL.
Would this be the proper time to propose an amendment?
No, not right at the moment. I'm not in a work session. I'm just in a hearing. And what I would always urge anyone, that we have problems, show me the proof, show me scientific basis and data, and I don't have any here. So,
well,
I would suggest that the sponsor of the bill bring this. We'll leave it open here, but I was given some because I asked for it. Okay? And there has been some work done. And I really always would suggest that we talk about this. Talk about it with some scientific basis, please. I know that's what we're trying to establish here, but there has been some work done on the river.
Representative.
We're not talking about that. We're just making blank statements here, and that's not fair.
Representative Walsh, I can address that. I do have, for example, information from the fish regulations, which do list health advisories, one for the Columbia Slough and one for the Lower Columbia River. Both of them have been listed for PCB levels that have been considered dangerous for human consumption. The tests have been done. There is some information out there. I would not like to say at all that there has been no work done. My point being that there has been work done, but there are holes in the database that we have. Thank you.
Questions from the committee?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I think I made it when we were addressing this bill once before, and that is that I think this kind of monitoring has importance as this witness just mentioned for the Lower Columbia as well, while it's not in this bill now. We fish around Tongue Point in the estuary for the sturgeon, and that's the place where we find them, and it also is the place where the Navy housed a lot of ships and where we're now considering a shipbreaking operation. And so I think information is a good thing. Based on the information we've been given so far, we know that we shouldn't consume sturgeon from that area regularly, on a regular basis, and most of us who live there have cut our consumption, but I appreciate the proponents of the bill who say that we do have a growing non-English-speaking population, so if they see a fish and the water looks good, you know, they take it home and it becomes a part of their regular diet. So I think the intent of the bill is really good, and as it's been amended to narrow it, I could support it, though I think it actually has much broader application than just possible.
Mr. Chair,
I grew up near the Columbia Slough and was there virtually every weekend. And the last few years I've again been there regularly, and I see people fishing in the sluice and whatever regularly, and there are a few signs posted, but it's very clear people are consuming fish who are not aware of the risk and are selling them and passing them on to a community that aren't aware of the risk. And I think it's part of that sort of observations that initially triggered this bill.
certainly, whatever information the chair needs, I hope it can be forthcoming to enable us to consider this bill in a work session.
Other questions? Okay, I will not move on this today, but if there's others who want to give testimony, we'll have some more.
Okay.
Catherine Barnett.
Chair Welch, members of the committee, Catherine Panetta, Governmental Affairs Manager for the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. There are two pieces of data coming around to you. One is a report prepared by McCaffey about dioxin to provide you with some background information about dioxin to answer some of your questions. The word has been loosely bandied around today, and this does fill in some gaps about detection levels, cogeners of dioxin, the fact that there are 19 different cogeners of dioxin. When you say dioxin, you might be talking about a pentaform, a tetraform, a hexaform, are specifically the most common fingerprint that's associated with the pulp and paper mill is a tetraform of dioxin called 2378-TCDD. And the other information, and these are all backed up by scientific papers, you'll note there is a bibliography attached. The other, in response to questions about types of studying that are being done, is the top of a study that I will present for the record. And to put it on a record, the investigation of the distribution of organochlorine and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon compounds in the Lower Columbia River using semi-permeable membrane devices. This is a U.S. Geological Survey Water Resources Investigative Report, number 99-4051. It was just completed. It's been underway for the last couple of years. And this type of detection method used in looking at PAHs and organochlorine compounds and in the river goes down to subparts per quadrillion. And this is the newest type of technology that is being used out there. The third thing that I would like to put on the record is, and I will give it to you, is a briefing packet that the DEQ is using on the Willamette River dated March 1999. And in here, they talk about the status of the Newberg Pool study area. And if I may, I might read that the 1997 Oregon legislature appropriated $313,400 to DEQ to conduct a study in the Newberg Pool on the Willamette River to follow up on abnormally high incidences of skeletal deformities identified in fish in an earlier phase of the Willamette River study, which has been going on since 1990. The Newberg Pool study was divided into the following components. A human health study, as we've been discussing today, focused on consumption of fish caught in the Newberg Pool and identification of contaminants of concern detected in fish tissue, and two, an ecological study designed to quantify more precisely the extent and spatial distribution of fish with skeletal deformities. And this briefing packet in its whole is available from the DEQ, but I will again submit it to the record. I am curious if the Division of Health did not have the resources to do this work, why they didn't come forward with a bill this session to do this. And that I am curious about and talk to people who are interested in these issues, as we have been past contributors to studies on the Willamette River. Our interest in these issues and our interest in them has been well established. As far as our position on the Dash 2 amendments, I'm not sure what a long-term monitoring plan program that measures, among other things, the level and trend of pollution concentration in water sediment and aquatic tissue.
that's rather vague and undefined, and I'm not sure that we have established on the record to go forward with this bill all the work that the DEQ has done on this subject. But we would be happy to work with the proponents of the bill to seek a solution that could build on the work that has been done in the past.
Trustee Devlin, would you be willing to work with Captain Banana and pulp paper industry and look at some other details and go forward?
Mr. Chairman, I would. If I might add maybe one or two other people to the working group.
Well, our working group is wide open. There's no restrictions as far as I'm concerned. There's always people that are interested and concerned. Health Department, DEQ.
I'd be willing to do that.
Okay. All right.
Well,
others seem to know.
Just have one question. Where does the lower Willamette River start? Does that start at Newburgh?
I don't know either. I know about. The Health Department wants to make another comment
real quick. Mr. Chair, again, Tom Johnson, Assistant Administrator, Oregon Health Division. In addition to the questions that we helped address with Representative Devlin, we did have some information that we would like to present. As Representative Devlin indicated, there is a fair amount of data that exists, but that data was collected for a variety of purposes other than human health effects. There's good scientific evidence, and I think a lot of evidence available, that there are problems with contamination in that northern part of the Willamette River. There are, however, as was indicated, data gaps. We don't have enough data available in Health Division to allow us to make human health assessments and make health advice. We increasingly are approached by other agencies, DEQ, Fish and Wildlife, others. We get a lot of inquiry from the public about concern for the contaminants in the Willamette River. The bill, as written, the Dash 2 Amendment, defines the study area from the mouth of the Yamhill River north, from there to the Columbia. That is probably the area reasonably that has the greatest concern. We would frankly find it to be very useful to us to have the opportunity to conduct this study and see what is there, do some assessment. We think it would be important to have this additional data to identify where the data gaps are and to lay in place a program that would allow us to have the data to answer questions to ourselves, to other agencies, and probably more importantly, to the public. This is certainly something that is an issue for the public in that part of the state.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. We'll continue in a work group. Anyone else want to work with Stephanie Krikori? Anyone else want to work with Stephanie Krikori and Devlin? No, that's fine. No, they're welcome there. I just was going to see if there's another representative here.
Mr. Chairman, I would assume by that reference that we have some latitude in terms of timing on this bill. When we get back to you, probably the first of next week.
Yeah, I would appreciate that. Yeah.
We have latitude
from
5 o'clock.
I don't have any further business. Everything else we're going to bring on the table for the day. Stephanie Morgan has had to leave, so she had to go back to district for some family reasons tonight. So I think we're pretty well finished everything else that we needed to at this point in time, as far as I know, having no further business. We adjourn for today.
Well, you're hanging in there for sure.
your car. Oh, dear.
I'm going to have you.